Tony Martin and Tony Wilson on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
As you should know, listeners, we play all the music live in the studio. Pull those bongos down, Tony. Welcome. We've made it to a second show.
We have. We've already been warned that it's traditionally the flat one.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I walked in and they said, second show, so it's always a difficult time. You're going to have to work against the lactic acid that you built up last night. Somehow get it out of your system and produce something listenable over the next 3 hours.
Have we heard anything from Derek Giel? I mean, have we got notes? Surely, John, our producer next, or nothing from Derek? He hasn't left a note saying he's busy with the conversation hour this week.
Doing it all this week.
Yeah.
And leaving us in this. There's actually a Giel shape in your chair that he has carved out over many years. And your slightly bony Kiwi back there does not fill the Giel-shaped hole.
I'm not Giel-shaped. I think he's also got a lot of commitments with his band. Do we work? Is it the Derek Giel Experience?
The Derek Giel Phenomenon.
Big Giel Keep On Turning. I don't know what it's called, but
Fisher's Giels.
We've clear idea. Stop now. I think. Goodness, we're talking about big stories. This to me is, I don't know if this is really a big story, but Hitler is in the news today. Have you seen this?
Absolutely.
39 living relatives of Adolf Hitler have been discovered by a customs official and a journalist who claim to have decoded the Nazi dictator's DNA. This is in today's age, analysing forgotten cigarette butts in a small village in Lower Austria, a used paper serviette in a New York fast food restaurant, and the seals of letters sent over 30 years ago from northern France. Two blokes say that they had traced all the known living relatives of the Führer for the first time, as well as three living in America whose existence has been reported previously. They claim to have tracked down 36 others who still live in the wooded area of Austria where Hitler was born.
Woodlands.
And listen to this. The American relatives have agreed not to have children in order to extinguish the saga of Hitler and stop living in fear. This has got to end now. They wouldn't have the surname Hitler, would they? They wouldn't be in the phone book Hitler.
Well, they'd surely have changed it or made it a double T or something.
Exactly.
It's impossible that they would be a Hitler. In fact, it'd be interesting to see if there is a single Hitler in the Melbourne phone book.
Give us a call. If you're Hitler, give us a call. Obviously, Hitler, a big draw card for comedy over the years. He's really been a figure of fun for some time now. I went to see the producers on Broadway in New York a few years ago, and there was something incredibly powerful about sitting in a Broadway theatre with let's not beat about the bush, a predominantly Jewish production and a large Jewish contingent in the audience just laughing at Adolf Hitler, you know, less than half a century after World War II. There was something kind of, even though it was a comedy, there was something kind of powerful about that.
And there's I saw the Australian production, and it was, I thought it was fantastic. Bert playing one of the major, the pigeon fancying
Nazi,
Bert Newton.
That's right. I know he doesn't often Nazi up, but he did on that occasion. There's a famous sketch on the TV show, American sketch comedy show, Mr. Show, where they posit an alternative reality where the DNA of Hitler has been used to clone hundreds of Hitlers who are forced to live in subservience to Jewish families, just dressed as Hitler, performing tasks around the house. And when their master dies, they're set free, and all the Hitlers live in it, sort of hang out in a bar together.
Well, it's interesting that look, the Hitler look, that I know you've written something on this about the fact that really who came first out of Charlie Chaplin and Hitler is in terms of that moustache.
Well, see, I was speaking to a young person recently who didn't know the chronology and went, right, so Charlie Chaplin was sending up Hitler with that moustache.
Because he made The Great Dictator, which with the scene that is the great Hitler send-up scene of the late... of
it was about 1940, I think. But Chaplin was wearing the Hitler moustache, or the toothbrush moustache, as it's known, in 1913. And, I noted that, really, when you think of Hitler moustaches, there's only five, isn't there? There's Hitler, Chaplin, Oliver Hardy, Peter Sellers as Fred Kite in I'm All Right, Jack, and Blakey from On the Buses.
That's it.
So you've got Hitler and four comedians. And Chaplin and Hardy have come first.
So why does Hitler go that in
so
that direction?
So isn't that odd? Isn't that odd in 1933 or whenever Hitler...
No, let's put him all the way back to 1920.
So he's
doing the beer hall putsch in the early 20s.
He's got the moustache.
Starting his party.
He's wearing it then.
But I don't know if he's got his... That's another question for the listeners. Does Hitler have his moustache in the early 20s when he's doing his beer hall
was
putsch?
Did he have the moustache when Noah Taylor played him in that film where he was the young Hitler with John Cusack?
I didn't see that.
It's called Max. And it was about the young Hitler, was Noah Taylor. But I can't remember if he had the moustache, because that's intriguing to me, the idea that a bloke would attempt to terrify the world into accepting his final solution while wearing what must have been a Charlie Chaplin moustache.
It's. I mean, who is the biggest comedian in the world at the moment that has a look? Would it be... It's hard to really think of one, but it's
well, the example I thought of was it's like Saddam Hussein wearing a carrot top wig.
Yeah.
When he's marching into... I mean, so it must have been an odd decision. Surely someone would have taken Hitler aside. I said, mate, you look like an idiot.
Yeah.
We're not going to terrify people throughout Europe if you're looking like the world's most famous comedian.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem right to me.
At least go with Buster Keaton. It's a less obvious look.
The flat hat and the flap shoes.
This story, though, the 39 living relatives, when I was speaking to Lindy, building this up this hour, trying to really spruik it, it did sort of dawn on me that tomorrow, don't you reckon this the we were wrong sign is likely to appear next to it? What's the likelihood of a customs official and a journalist... nutting this out with serviettes and what was the other thing he used?
Paper serviettes and cigarette butts.
I mean, first of all, you need your map to work off. So did they extract Hitler DNA out of the bunker? Where do they have their, you know, the control? And then how do you test all cigarette butts that are going through a southern Austrian village? Do you go to any random restaurant in New York and hope that Hitler's DNA is going to turn up?
There's not a lot of detail attached to this article. It feels to me like an expanded odd spot. Let me give you the phone number here, 1300 222. I'm allowing people to write this down, you'll notice. 222-774, 1300 222-774, or you can SMS us on 19-774-774. We want to hear, are you related, not to Hitler, although that would be interesting, but to anybody at all?
Distant celebrity relatives.
Mm.
Basically, you might have a huge relative that's your brother, and I guess we'll allow Barry Humphries' brother to call up if they like.
It can be by marriage.
Yep.
It can be in law.
It can be second cousins. It can even be someone you thought you were related to and it's turned out you're not.
Let's have some music. I think we'll... what have we got, John? Have we got something exciting queued up for the people? Oh, a bit of JJ Cale, one of Hitler's favourites, here on 774. That'd be JJ Cale with Hey Baby here on 774 Melbourne and ABC Victoria. We're suffering from a few computer problems here this evening, so I apologise if there's been any bizarre moments on here, aside from the fact that it's not Derek Gill, clearly, if you've just tuned in tonight wondering where Derek is. It's myself, Tony Martin. Tony Wilson is with me. And we're talking about distant relatives of famous people. Because 13...
You might be one.
Yeah, that's right. 39 relatives of Hitler have been identified today. We're not sure why, for what reason, or what's going to happen to them. But, you know, and are we looking really for... Are we seeking to be impressed here by...
No.
It's almost the opposite of that, isn't it, Tony?
Well, can I give you an example? Because I think you're claiming not to have a distant celebrity relative that you know
of. Not that I know of. My sister, my recently discovered half-sister, was on Australia's Got Talent, playing in the string quartet, Godiva, playing, if you saw it, She was playing The Final Countdown by Europe.
Well, mine...
That's pretty... I know, you're impressed. That's it.
Mine isn't really... he's a great Australian, really. He died last year, 15th of November last year. Ivan Southall died.
Who's that?
Ivan Southall won an award, the 1971 Carnegie Medal, the only Australian children's writer to ever win this international award. And he published 40 books or something between 1950 and the late 90s.
And what books would we...
Ash Rhodes, his most famous.
Right.
That won Australian Children's Book of the Year in, I think, 1966 or something like that.
How many are you up to? You're up to five children's books?
Five children's books.
Wow. And
in fact, I got called by my aunt this week because she was in a bookshop and said that, I always like to keep my eye out for Ivan Southall, she said, because I'm related to Ivan Southall. And the bookshop owner said, well, Ivan Southall's daughter is in the back of the shop. Go and meet her.
Fantastic.
So... The Southall connection, so not really a household name for most people, but he's the sort of person we're looking for. You might just have a little quirk on the edge of Australian life of someone who's done something who's related to you.
The bar is low, is what Tony is saying on line one, according to this post-it note that I've been handed. We have Bob. Bob, who are you related to? Oh, dear. He's related to the Invisible Man.
Bob?
No, no sign of Bob.
What about line two?
Let's see if Dennis is with us. Are you there, Dennis?
Yeah, hi.
Oh, hello, Dennis. Sorry about the frogs in the system this evening. Who are you related to?
Well, it's not that so much. It's adding some grist to the mill. I got an email a couple of months ago suggesting that Angela Merkel, the current Chancellor of Germany and now President of the European Community, I see, is the daughter of Adolf Hitler, engendered by artificial insemination, presumably 8 years after the war, out of Eva Braun's younger sister.
Wow.
Right.
Even the internet's done well to come up with that one.
And you, but you yourself, nobody?
Not that I can think of.
You sure?
Well, we've done our family tree back to the 1520 something or other, but, you know, there's no... There was a ship's captain and there was a few odd people here and there, you know, that's nothing way out of the no one famous that anyone would know.
Well, thank you very much for that call. To give you a little bit more of the flavour of what we're looking for, Lisa, who is working with us here on the evening show tonight, she's taking the calls back there in the production hut. She is a fourth cousin to Mother Mary MacKillop.
Oh, wow, fantastic. And would you, you can nod, saintly, would you describe yourself? She's very saintly. There you go.
So that's the feel.
That's what we're looking for. Mike, I think, is with us. Mike, who are you related to?
Well, I want to continue that German Hitler connection. I reckon I'm... must be related about 55 times removed to a guy who tried to top Hitler in 1944 and got assassinated by him.
Oh, was which of the plotters is this?
He was actually a prime minister of one of the puppet governments of Hitler's during the war and joined the Stauffenberg plot.
Right.
And then finished up being put in jail and topped himself.
And was he depicted in that Valkyrie film?
Nah.
Didn't make the cut.
Didn't make the cut, no.
And why do you think you're related to him? Same surname?
Because same surname and our family's all come in Australia from one German who turned up in Australia in 1850 and this guy in 1944 had exactly the same name.
What's his name?
Gustav Noske.
Not the Gustav Noske.
Oh, yeah, that's the one.
That's very close to Gustav Nossel as a name, isn't it?
It is, and I always wondered about that connection.
Will we accept that, Tony? Will we accept that your name is slightly similar?
Yeah, we haven't got any DNA, but we do have...
geneticists should feel free to come to ring in as well and tell us how long this story is going to survive with its paper napkin intrigue. To me, it seems like it's going to get blown out of the water pretty quickly.
Well, I wonder if you thought you might be a relative of Hitler's, why you'd ever give anybody a paper napkin or indeed a straw.
That's right. Keep it to yourself, I would have thought. Thank you.
I would have thought so.
Mike, we've got Matthew from Mount Eliza. Who are you related to, Matthew?
Oh, it's actually Adam, but I'm actually related, it's second cousin to Matthew Newton.
Oh, right. Sorry, I called you Matthew. You're a second cousin to Matthew Newton.
So my mum is Patty's cousin. So there you go.
Did you get invited to the wedding?
No, I didn't, but my mother did.
And have you run into Bert at any point?
I haven't. I actually, funnily enough, I haven't seen Matt or Bert since I was about five, but Patty and Lauren I catch up with quite a bit.
And the head size gene, has it run through your strand of the family as well, or is it?
Funnily enough, no, but there is a similarity between Matthew and myself.
It's always a surprise when you see Bert in civvies, I find, because you get so used to seeing him in the suit and tie.
Yes.
On TV, and he once came in on a radio show I was working on, and he came in a sort of a shell suit, you know, like a tracksuit that a British gangster would wear. And you know, I'm sure he won't mind me saying this, you know, off the telly he gets around sans the piece up top and a pair of mirrored sunglasses. He looked like Frank Butcher from EastEnders.
Well, there you go. Yeah,
EastEnders hard man.
He's certainly a character. I'll tell you what, he doesn't forget a name or a face. He's very good at that.
No, he's great. Thank you, Matthew.
Adam.
Yeah, Adam related to Matthew. We've got computer trouble. Everything I'm saying is off post-it notes tonight. We're surrounded by IT guys smashing at stuff with sledgehammers. Thank
good
you.
Luck.
Yeah, thanks. We'll need it. Craig is on the line from Melton. Craig, who are you related to?
Now, I'm not certain what this may be, but my mum is Margaret Court's cousin.
Now, pardon my ignorance, who is Margaret Court?
Margaret Court won about four or five Wimbledon. Wilson might probably know. Right. About four or five Wimbledons, I think, in the 60s.
Right, and did this lead to any, because of her name being Court, were there puns? Were there headlines?
Well, she was known as Margaret Smith by my mum, so she only got married, I think, well, she was almost retired.
Right.
By the time she got retired. So, I'm sure there were, but she'd sort of gone out of my mum's circle by the time she got married. They basically, like your previous caller, knew each other as kids, but you lose contact with your cousins over time, of course. And
what about you? Have you inherited any of her skill?
Absolutely none.
Well, Craig, do you know that she was in the quiz questions tonight? I had her down as a quiz question. You almost could have just stayed on the line and got the first one right yourself. But the question was, who has won the most Grand Slam singles titles? And it was meant to be a bit of a trick question, because people will naturally gravitate towards the recent record set by Roger Federer. But of course, Person would include Margaret. And she's won more. She won in the 20s. Federer's only won 15 or something.
Did you hear the quiz last night, Craig?
No, I missed that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was up to Giel standards.
Okay.
Yeah, it was below Giel. We're going to try and rectify that. Thank you for talking to us, Craig. John from Frankston, who are you related to?
Well, I'm going to cheat a bit, Tony. In actual fact, my father was in the Navy.
Right.
With a gentleman by the name of Ken Essex. Mm. Now, Ken Essex, he was a musician, and he played viola on Yesterday. He was in one of the string quartet.
Wow.
Navy. And he still corresponds with my mother. And he was a well-known session muso in London, played on a lot of really famous things. But I know that he's definitely on Yesterday.
Well, that's a pretty good get. And, of course, his work would have been severely remastered in the last few weeks.
Yes, I hope it didn't hurt, because he's getting on a bit. But the other thing is, this is actually, as far as I know, my father always maintained that his father was Viscount Allenby's Batman. Now, that was in Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes.
Now, Allenby was the British general who was liaising with Lawrence. And Allenby was pretty famous in Damascus and that sort of thing. And my dad always maintained that his father was Allenby's Batman, but I've never been able to find any proof.
It's an odd thing to make up, though, about yourself.
Well, it is, isn't it, really? But there you go.
All right. Well, thank you, John. That's
Can
beauty.
I just ask, Tony, not you, Tony, him, Tony.
Yes.
Tony Wilson.
I'm a children's librarian. I was just interested. Give me the name of a couple of books and I'll probably then recognise you.
Harry Highpants, Thirsty Flowers.
Right. I know who it is now. I don't know the names of the titles. Right.
And The Princess and the Packet of Frozen Peas.
Oh, that's the one I remember now. Well, congratulations. Thanks very much.
That's all right. Wow. Fantastic. We're back online. I feel great. We're back.
It is exciting, isn't it?
What do we do before computers? We have Simon from Mount Martha. You've got a very distant one. What's your side?
We've got a number of relatives, but I'm the 17th cousin of the late Queen Mother.
Wow. 17.
How does that work? What is a 17th cousin?
Very, very distant.
So basically you've branched off back in the day. Is there any member of your family who you could name who has actually met a Windsor?
Yes, I could. My uncle is Peter Hollingworth, so he obviously met the Windsors when he was GG.
Right, so how many people would have to drop dead for you to ascend the throne?
I couldn't. We're not royal related. We're obviously related through the Queen Mother, which doesn't actually make her a royal descendant. But we've got a whole bunch of quirky relatives, actually. We were the guys who carted the gunpowder for Guy Fawkes for the gunpowder plot.
Wow.
Yeah, that idiot.
Guy Fawkes.
We were relative to Anthony Babington, who was the fellow that tried to assassinate Queen Elizabeth I.
Right.
Wow.
So you're related to the Queen Mother and to several people who tried to bump them off. Having an each way bet there. Fantastic. Who else is on the list?
This is going to sound like a brag. We're also a really distant relative of a guy by the name of Baron Mulderbank, who is the third cousin to William, Duke of Normandy.
Wow.
And how did you discover all this? What website did you go to?
We actually didn't know any of it, and Peter didn't know any of it, but the same thing, we were asked to do a DNA test, and through a completely different and unrelated set of circumstances, and we came up a dead match for some people in the UK who were all related to these people, and obviously we were an exact DNA match for them, which made us all part of the same family.
And obviously related to someone from the gunpowder plot, you're obviously probably still under surveillance for that in some way.
That's the joke in the family, absolutely. We can't go back to the UK.
That's right. Even though it was completely unsuccessful, the gunpowder plot.
Yeah, it was a good try, though.
It was a good try. And I'm from New Zealand. I think it was a public holiday for several years because somebody failed to blow up a building.
Yeah, well, I must say, every time we get the day off for Guy Fawkes, you know, we give thanks for having been involved.
Well, good on you. I just saw our producer, John Standish, getting a massage from somebody in the next room. That's how severe the technical problems have been behind the scenes here tonight at 7.74.
This is hard to explain, but in radio there's a thing called a 7-second delay.
Yeah.
And that is that if anyone says something, say...
well, we know, it's been in the news a lot lately. Yeah, a certain sort of person hasn't been deploying it.
Exactly. If you make a mistake and say something incredibly offensive, you get the 7-second delay will kick in, and you can't, and you just hear yourself come back.
Yeah.
As you fall out of delay.
You hear what you said 7 seconds earlier. That's right.
What I just listened to before and watched was Tony Martin get kicked out of delay mid-sentence so that suddenly he's 7 seconds back into his past and then catch the sentence on the way out and continue seamlessly on once the delay had evaporated. It was beautiful.
It was bizarre because we were talking about Hitler and we've gone into delay, I think accidentally, and I've gone, oh, no, I haven't. What have I done? And my next words were final solution. So I was sitting here waiting to say those words. Dear, oh, dear, I apologise.
You do think something's wrong when your catchwords are final solution, don't you?
You do. Now, we are going to pick this up. We've got many more callers. Thanks to everybody who called in. You're listening to Tony Martin and Tony Wilson on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. We're going to cross now to Jim Graham in the newsroom. Hello, Jim.
G'day, Tony. The troubled Brimbank Council in Melbourne's West is about to be replaced by an administrator. A new report has found many of the 11 councillors have continued to act inappropriately. An earlier ombudsman's inquiry found the council was dysfunctional and riddled with infighting. Fresh elections will be held in 2012. The federal opposition says the government is using the threat of draconian regulation to force Telstra into helping build a new national broadband network. The government has announced regulatory changes that call on Telstra to separate its retail and wholesale businesses or face restrictions on its future operations. Employees of the Campbell's Soup Factory in Shepparton remain locked out of the plant tonight. Talks between the union and management to resolve a dispute over staff contracts have broken down. Management refused to let the workers back in after they held a 24-hour strike on Friday. And the British celebrity chef Keith Floyd has died of a heart attack. He was 65. Floyd shot to fame in the 1980s in various cooking shows, which he often fronted with a glass of wine in hand. We'll have more news at 8 o'clock.
Johnson Buzz, again short of the length, and he pulls and he's caught!
Cricket's on the radio.
Join Jim Maxwell and the grandstand commentary team.
Comes in and bowls to Payne. He's hit on the pad, how's that? Out!
One day internationals.
A big wicket for England, the crowd like that. Australia lead 3-0 and welcome back Ricky Ponting for Game 4 at Lord's.
One Day Internationals continue live from the UK. Tonight on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Grandstand Digital Radio.
Tony Martin and Tony Wilson on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
Nice guitar solo, Tony. We are talking tonight to people who are related, even distantly, to anybody at all. The bar cannot be low enough for this segment. Marie from Lower Plenty, who are you related to?
Good evening, Tony and Tony.
Good evening.
Now, it was the Liardi family.
Right, who are they?
Now, Papa Liardi, who's a great-great-uncle, great-great-great-great-great-uncle, he discovered Port Melbourne, and about 4 or 5 years ago, they commemorated a bust of him down there.
Wow.
So down in Port Melbourne, there's a bust of Liardi, because he discovered Port Melbourne.
So really, because let's think, isn't Port Melbourne only a K or two from Melbourne? So didn't the Melbourne people kick on to Port Melbourne, or was it too much work?
Well, it must have been too much work because he discovered, and I'm saying discovered,
yeah,
Port Melbourne.
In the Captain Cook sense.
Yes, but I also have a brag, but I don't know if it's true.
Yes.
Now, family history is, they say, right, and I've got to look into this myself one day, we can trace ourselves back to William Tell, right?
Wow.
And to Liechtenstein, to the Liechtenstein royal family. This is going back a long time, which means we could be related to Princess Diana's family.
Wow.
Could be.
Yeah.
Could be.
Yeah,
okay.
Now, I'm saying this is what has been talked about in the family, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got to look into it myself one day. But apparently it was traced back to William Tell. So there's one.
Well, you've got your own theme song.
And the other biggie is Princess Diana, the late Princess Diana.
Well, wow. that is impressive. Well,
keep us updated.
And we also had a Gallipoli survivor, my grandfather. Survived Gallipoli and Pozieres in France, and he came back. So,
well, that's quite a coterie. And the man.
Oh, look, I'm so proud of it. I'm standing here very proud.
The man who discovered Port Melbourne was standing there going, this one day will be filled with small, tiny Tuscan-style apartments, many
That's
of them with
right.
polystyrene walls.
Yeah.
Well, we've already given that Batman a mention in the Lawrence of Arabia sense. I think John Batman is credited with finding Melbourne, and a big cross next to him for not getting another 4K down the road to Port Melbourne.
No, but that belongs to us.
Yeah,
all right, we've got that. Nobody's disputing that.
Right?
Nobody's arguing that. Thank you, Marie.
Your condos.
John from Tony Wilson Country Northcote is with us. Who are you related to, John?
Very distantly, Marilyn Munro.
Very distantly, really? In what sense?
Well, my sister-in-law, her brother is married to Daniel Day-Lewis, the actor's sister.
Right.
Daniel Day-Lewis is married to Rebecca Miller. Rebecca Miller's father...
Arthur Miller.
...is Arthur Miller, and Arthur Miller was married to...
Marilyn Munro.
Exactly.
And so you didn't feel that Daniel Day-Lewis was impressive enough for our segment?
Not at all. I was much more interested in...
Or Arthur Miller. I would have thought he was quite high up as well.
As a family insider, are you privy to any knowledge about the actual circumstances of her death?
None at all, unfortunately. Unfortunately, nothing to do with the Kennedys or anything like that. But, it's an interesting relationship. But
have you ever popped a kilt on and stood over an airy grate?
not recently, no.
Have you ever been to a shopping centre in South Yarra and seen plastic reenactments of the moment?
No, I haven't, unfortunately.
I love that shopping centre because it's got... actors' names like Humphrey Bogart rendered in Helvetica, which I've never seen before. Orson Welles, none of his films would ever have played here, but there's his name in Helvetica. I love that. All right, thank you very much, John.
No worries.
John, we have Anna, another Anna from Melbourne on the line. Who are you related to, Anna?
Well, I'm glad you introduced marriage. My family is too large and too notorious to talk to my natural, so I'll talk about marriages. First, Polish, the son, or let's say my father-in-law, whom I never met, went to school with Helena Rubinstein, studied chemistry at Krakow University.
And you'll have to help us with who Helena Rubinstein is.
Well, you know the big cosmetic company? Cosmetics?
Yes, yes. Neither Tony and I are really across
cosmetics.
I thought you might apply them every day.
So she invented something big like lipstick, did she?
Probably, yes. Yeah, I don't use her brand myself, actually. But, my late first father-in-law studied chemistry with her in Krakow. So, and my second husband's uncle invented electroshock, Italian.
Wow.
Invented electroshock therapy.
Psychiatrist, yes. His name was Lucio Bini.
Right, well, okay.
For the moment, we'll see later on, but for the moment, no more marriages.
No. Well, lipstick or electroshock therapy.
You can have both.
Quite a family.
At the same time.
And of course, the only I'll tell you a lipstick fact I know. Filmmaker Preston Sturges invented kiss-proof lipstick.
Really?
Before he turned to filmmaking, there you go. That's right. I'm blowing all our good questions for the quiz early on.
Do you remember when 99? Used to kiss people, or was there someone who had lipstick that was poisoned and when they kissed them, they'd die? Was that in Get Smart?
I don't remember that. Are you sure you didn't dream that?
Just wondering whether that's possible or not. I was going to ask our caller then.
Anything is possible. You're listening to Tony Martin and Tony Wilson on 774 ABC Melbourne, ABC Victoria, of course. Time for some music. Mr. Brightside, will you sign in, please, from The Killers? Mr. Brightside here at 774 ABC Melbourne, ABC Victoria, with myself, Tony Martin, and Tony Wilson sitting in the Derek Gill-shaped chairs this evening. And with us on, well, I guess it's a couch, it's a crime couch. Welcome, Rochelle Jackson.
Thank you, Tony.
We're on the crime couch, I understand.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about the couch. Obviously, regular listeners know, but we've not experienced
You've
the couch.
You've not experienced sitting on the couch?
We haven't. First time.
It's a bit of your cheap upholstered sort of a situation as far as the couch is concerned. And I bring on all sorts of people. I suppose the only thing that kind of keeps it all together is the fact that it's all to do with crime. So it can be police individuals, it can be the occasional crook or villain, a forensic science individual. And look, tonight we've got a couple of really great authors. We've got a crime fiction author and we've also got a true crime author. I suppose that's what we kind of like to do. We bring them in and have a bit of a chat and discuss what they're up to.
Just before we get to your authors, who has caused the most trouble on the crime couch, do you think, over the years?
A couple of weeks ago we had Brian the Skull Murphy, and he's a former Victoria Police individual who's just put out his own biography.
Right.
Let's just say he was on his best behaviour. He was a scintillating interview talent. And, yeah, look, it was interesting to hear him actually answer questions rather than be in the box.
See, so when you say Brian Murphy, I think of George from George and Mildred, but that's somebody else. He wouldn't be on the crime couch.
No, probably not.
He'd be on the sitcom couch. We don't have that evening. Have you had Roger Rogerson on
your
couch?
No, haven't had Roger Rogerson sitting on the couch. I approached him at one stage to do a chapter in my second book, because I write true crime, but no, he wanted certain things that I couldn't deliver, i.e. dollars. So that was out of the question.
Have you ever had a moment where a criminal has been announced as a criminal sort of on air? Have you had crimes sort of arise?
No, I think most individuals that come on that have got a criminal background certainly wouldn't be speaking confessionally on air, but I think they're pretty skilled operators, most of them that come in. We've had Billy the Texan Longley come in and have a chat with us, and Freddie Keiko, who's now doing some time in Barwon Prison for armed robbery, and we've had a number of different people.
Because I watched Blue Murder again recently, and it's just a fantastic series. And I was watching it going, in 1994, 95, when it came out, if you had said that that bloke, that Roger Rogerson, will be playing comedy clubs within 10 years. That's an odd thing, isn't it?
It is an odd thing.
Didn't he go on tour?
Yeah, he did that with Chopper Reid at one stage for a very short period of time.
And Mark Jacko Jackson.
That's correct.
Who doesn't really have a record, does he?
He has a single.
Eyeing on.
I was just going to say.
Where's
yeah.
the drummer? Well, you should have been in with the drum then, John.
But look, I suppose we better get on with it.
Yes, we better.
We've got on the couch tonight, we've got Catherine Fox. Now, Tony and Tony Squared, she's a medical practitioner. She lives in Sydney. She's got a special interest in forensic medicine. She's just published her latest book, which is called Bloodborne. And I suppose she's written best-selling books, Malicious Intent, Without Consent and Skin and Bone. Her books have been translated into over a dozen languages. And this is her latest book, as I've said, Bloodborne. Welcome to the Crime Couch, Catherine. How are you going there?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Look, congratulations on Bloodborne. It's a real thrilling read. I'd describe it, dare I use the cliche, but it is a page turner. One of the most fascinating things that I found about your book is, of course, that you are a forensic examiner or a medical examiner yourself. You've got a medical practice. Just how close is your main character in this book, which is a Dr. Anya Crichton? How close is she to you?
She's not very close at all in some ways. My interest in forensic medicine actually came through, believe it or not, general practice, because forensic medicine is different from pathology, which determines cause and manner of death. But forensic medicine actually sees survivors of fairly offensive assaults like rape, domestic violence, and you become actually adept at wound and you become more expert at wound examination and documentation for courts and things like that. So I ended up seeing child abuse, sexual abuse, rape victims, domestic violence victims, having to document all of those things actually through the happy old general practice. So Anya is my ideal person for that occupation because I couldn't survive in it with my personality. I care too much, if you like, and I've had to create a character who was a little bit detached, but as a consequence, she is not very good at small talk, she's not very social, in fact, she's slightly antisocial, whereas I'm sort of nicknamed Have a Chat, so, you know, I'll be on a plane for half an hour and know half the people on board. In fact, Tony, I met Brian Murphy at a crime writing festival.
There we go.
George from George and Mildred.
I see.
He's married to a crime writer.
Oh, really?
Are you serious?
I am serious. She's a beautiful younger actress who now writes crime.
Right. So, and obviously she would be nothing like Eutha Joyce, I'm assuming.
No, the late Eutha. He was talking about her, but I didn't know how to say to him, were you George from George and Mildred? Because it was pretty clear that he was. So I just said, have you been classically trained in the arts? And he puffed out his chest and pulled up his high pants and was very thrilled.
And was able to prove it instantly.
Yes.
Catherine, how do you... Okay, so you've done this stuff for real. At what point do you decide I'm going to have a crack at writing fiction? And what was your first step?
I think... It's interesting, the experience. I actually met the Dalai Lama. It goes back to when I was 16. I met the Dalai Lama and he came to the school I was at in Canberra, which was a course on world religions we were doing, and we invited him.
You got the Dalai Lama?
Yes.
We got the Fanta yo-yo team and the bloke with the lung in a Perspex box.
We had them too.
Fantastic.
But we got the Dalai Lama and he came to school and I was set on doing medicine. I was determined to do medicine. And he came up and, you know, the nylon carpet, little slippers, came across and said to me, I'm so glad to have finally met you. And as he shook my hand, I got this static electricity sort of shock. And I was serving tea and coffee, and so, of course, I just thought he was really thirsty. And he was saying, I'm so glad to have finally met you. And
What did he mean by that?
Well, that's what's really odd.
He knew you in a previous life?
I don't know. I just thought he was thirsty, so I gave him a cup of tea. But someone in his entourage said, maybe His Holiness likes the book you haven't written yet.
Really?
And I thought, no, I'm going to do medicine. So it wasn't until years later when I was sitting there fairly frustrated in general practice that I thought, maybe he was right, because purportedly he can see all your past and future lives on contact when he makes physical contact. I know, and it's maybe, but you know what? My first reaction, very sadly, was, what a fantastic line. If you were starting a cult, what a fabulous way to recruit. It's an evil, evil line to recruit victims. So I thought then, maybe in retrospect, it is pretty clear that I was going to be a crime writer.
And obviously the Dalai, you know, quite useful in solving crimes, I would have thought.
Maybe not.
There's maybe a book about solving Dalai Lama. And so when do you...
Do you send him chapters? As you're going along?
No, no. If he's already read them, But he's already read them.
But it fascinates me with when you're starting to write a crime novel for the first time. I mean, there must be so many cliches that you find yourself stumbling into or having to avoid. Were there a lot of, you know, crossing things out and starting all over again?
I think I wrote about 30 drafts. But I was actually really fortunate and a freak of nature, if you like, really lucky time, everything. I wrote 10 chapters. And sent them to a publisher and Pan Macmillan, and I was offered a 2-book deal. But it took me 7 years to get those 10 chapters, I have to say, part-time. And I was determined to tell this story. And the story, actually, Malicious Intent was my first book, and it stemmed from my beginnings with that World Religions course on behavioural manipulation and how to modify behaviour by being nice, being unpleasant, exactly what organised religions live on, really.
What can you do, Catherine, in crime fiction that you can't do as a medical practitioner?
Oh, that's a great question. A lot more. I think I'm actually, maybe I'm completely idealistic and delusional, but I think I'm actually saving more lives now than I did in a surgery on a one-to-one basis.
In that what way? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think I've had so much feedback. It's been really interesting. One of the forensic physicians in the UK actually changed the way sexual assault examinations are done in her unit based on one of the scenes in Malicious Intent because of the compassion that my character shows, which is exactly how I would do that examination. But by reading through a character's viewpoint, she's seen how much more compassionate and empowering it can be, and so therefore modified her own unit's examinations. And we could discuss protocols till the cows came home, but it was only when she read through the eyes of a victim that she realised how much better an examination could be. It can never be great, but can always be better. And I've had women's groups come and say that they'd never hesitate to be examined. Someone else said, gosh, I would have automatically have helped this gentleman who had a bag of nappies, but because one of my scenarios warned her, if you like, and she thought twice about helping him because he wanted to go down and try and find a capsule place or car capsules or something, and he was in Ireland. And she went home thinking, no, I've seen that in a book, I don't want to go down that path. And turns out there were a series of rapes that night in Dublin. So, you know, it's really interesting that you can affect change.
That's really interesting for me because, like, I know as a true crime author, I suppose to a certain extent you do often have messages in your books, but as a crime fiction author, I'm kind of wondering, is that something that you think's important? You know, do you think you can actually... Because I know with Bloodborne, you actually focus a lot on domestic violence and sexual abuse. So are these the sort of messages, take-home messages, that you're wanting your readers to sort of go away with?
Yeah, I do. I want them to have a thrilling read as well. I mean, I'm an entertainer, that's my role. But if I can impart knowledge and just challenge the way people think a little bit, then I think I've done something more than just written a book. And I think reality fiction, the way I sort of write it, is quite powerful. And one of the things I think that differs in crime fiction is that television series, often the crime is incidental and the victim's incidental, and that's just the start of the story and then you move on. Whereas in crime fiction, what I try to do is the whole reason for the story is the victim.
We're talking to Catherine Fox, crime fiction author and medical practitioner. The latest book is called Bloodborne here on 774, and it is 5 to 8. Catherine, can I just ask, you know, your books have been so successful. Malicious Intent actually knocked off the Da Vinci Code, didn't it, on Amazon at one point?
It did, on Amazon in the UK and Germany.
Surely somebody must be itching to turn these books into a TV series or a film.
Well, the BBC at one stage was looking at, I think, the Anya character, the forensic physician character, but Silent Witness was doing really well. And,
oh, right.
And someone said, oh, maybe it's a bit too similar. And I'm thinking, but Silent Witness deals with dead bodies. Mine deals with live ones. So, you know, it's all in who's in charge at the time. You know about television. So
yes.
It's quite a fickle industry, if you like. But I don't mind that because I think at the moment, you know, people are reading the books and I'm really excited by that.
Why do you think people are so fascinated? I've even heard that there's been an enormous intake in sort of people wanting to become forensic scientists. Is that accurate?
It is, but the jobs haven't necessarily become apparent either. So funding hasn't increased.
Right, so people don't really live in the spectacular apartments that Jane Halifax had in Halifax FP.
She did have a good apartment, but no, they don't, apparently. They're struggling to make a living, and the crime labs are terribly underfunded. But I think one of the reasons they're so popular is we've had a decline in a few things. We've had a decline in organised religion. We've had an increase in science actually solving really awful problems like cold cases. If science could solve the Beaumont killers case, you know, that would be just brilliant. We'd all want that to happen. And I think we have this renewed faith in science, often a blind faith, which isn't necessarily a good thing. But they involve stories, the whole forensic and the medicine and the science and the closure at the end and justice prevailing. It starts off in a chaos and then becomes organised and structured, and then the world is put right again, as right as it can be. So I think it's almost like reading a fairy tale.
And Catherine, you were saying it that you're primarily an entertainer. Is there a moment in your latest book where you think, this isn't quite how it is if you're working as a forensic doctor, but for the sake of this story and to make it entertaining, I'm going to have to cut a few corners and it's going to be a bit quicker or a bit more glamorous or sexier or something like that?
I don't do sexier. but the things with DNA can take months to come back. But in fiction, it's as long as you need it to take to come back to propel your story.
Have you thought of going down the Tara Moss route and putting yourself on the front of the book yourself?
I'm not a spectator sport.
Okay.
Good response.
Remember, I'm a doctor and I'm older than Tara. So.
And just really quickly, I'd be curious to know, as an author, how do you juggle your medical practice with writing crime fiction?
Well, for a little while it was tricky because I was as cautious about patients thinking that I was going to be using them. But I don't practice now because the books have taken off overseas and I'm touring a lot now too. I had to give up. And to be honest, I was ready to give up. I think the final straw that broke my back, if you like, was spending 3 hours with a domestic violence victim whose husband had tried to kill her the preceding night. And I arranged accommodation for her, the children, got the kids picked up from school. Apparently the husband was out with a gun going to kill her and whoever she was with. So I cleared the surgery, locked us in, and after 3 hours, she decided to go back to him. And it was a really important lesson, I think, for me as well, because she was the one living with that fear, and that it's a horrific thing to live with every day. You can't even fall asleep without thinking, is he going to kill me in my sleep? So she was the one suffering with that and living with that, and she decided to go back. But then I spent the whole weekend listening to the radio and television for her murder. And that's when I had to cut back. And the idea of writing and just being that little bit detached, I think, is fantastic.
Well, Catherine, Bloodborne is in the shops now, is it not?
Yes, it is.
It certainly is. And, of course, the back catalogue as well. Thanks for joining us on the Crime Couch.
Thank you for having me.
Tonight.
Thanks, Catherine.
And good luck with your harp playing. I understand you're a harp player.
Oh, thank you, Tony. I'm an aspiring harp player.
Good on you. Well, I don't think there's a lot of competition in the field these days. Thank you very much. And you're going to stick around because we're not finished. We're going to move up on the couch.
We are.
Right, Rochelle?
We're moving up onto the couch, onto the two-seater, two-and-a-half-seater. We're going to be speaking to another true crime author, Susanna Lopez, about her latest book, Dangerous to Know.
And, Sean McAuliffe is joining us. And I've just realised he's written a crime telly movie. It's all crime tonight, 774.
That's all right.
Tony Martin and Tony Wilson on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
We're dancing on the crime couch tonight.
Maracas for me.
Sean McAuliffe is going to be coming in about half an hour's time, but we are on the crime couch and Rochelle Jackson is with us. We've all bunched up down one end because we've got yet another visitor. Who is it?
We've moved in another person on the couch. It's Susanna Lopez. Now, I love Susanna's little bit of bio. An actor turned barrister turned broadcaster and now author. Now, look, she's just published her, with another, her fellow author, James Morton, Dangerous to Know, an Australasian crime compendium. It's published by Melbourne University Publishing and it's their second true crime compilation, I suppose. Their last book, of course, was Gangland Australia. So welcome to the couch, Susanna. Congratulations on such an extraordinarily comprehensive tome.
Does that mean it's the world's most readable
doorstop. What exactly is a crime compendium?
Look, we didn't want to use the word encyclopedia because it's supposed to put people off. So short of almanac, compendium was the next one we came up with.
Does encyclopedia put people off?
I think so.
Does it? Because I did a book of essays and I was told not to put the word stories on the front because that implies short stories. And apparently short stories is the second most off-putting word you can put on the front
next
of a book.
Next to encyclopedia.
No, next to poetry.
Poetry would be a big one,
that's
yeah.
The big one. Don't put that on the front of your book.
So what did you have to put on yours?
You put the title, which is Nest of Occasionals, which won't disillusion anyone.
No, that's just confusing.
It sounds like a bunch of coffee tables,
that's
if you ask me.
That's what I'm hoping people will think.
What motivated you to write this book?
Look, that's a really big one. And I think it boils down, when I really distill it, to wanting to know why. I mean, I know you've written about the criminal mind, and I can't help but want to know why people do it, what distinguishes the person who has a predisposition to crime to those who don't. I also ask the question, why is my son, my 12-year-old son, 10 to 20 times more likely to become a criminal than my 10-year-old daughter? Because, of course, crime is primarily a young male game.
How's it going for him? Has he started yet?
No, he's keeping his nose clean at the moment. Right. But, you know, come age 15, 16, up to age 24, of course, that's when most of the male crime happens. And what we're seeing in Australia at the moment throughout the country is an epidemic of street violence, perhaps fueled by alcohol, perhaps fueled by drugs, but never before have we seen this extent of street violence. Perhaps in the 1920s when the Lairs and the gangs and the street gangs and the razor gangs were out running around Sydney and Melbourne, then we saw some of it.
There was a lot of penny farthing jackings, I think, in those days.
And you know, in those days, Tony, that the magistrates who saw matters coming before the court, 50% of the matters that they saw were public drunkenness.
Really?
Hello. Now it's a badge of honour, isn't it?
That's right.
And wasn't it also unusual crimes that now don't exist, like consorting, which is one of my favourite... consorting.
What is,
you know,
consorting?
Like, consorting means
hanging out with bad dudes.
Associating bad individuals.
Just being seen with them.
Kind of hanging out with them, yeah.
But, you know, see, it's really interesting. That was brought in 1929 to deal with the crooks that they couldn't get on any other charges during the Darlinghurst Razor Wars, etc. So consorting was, you know, hang out with a bad dude, get a bad name and get done.
So just hosting,
just knowing them.
Hosting the crime couch,
yes,
would have been an offence.
Would have been an offence, an indictable offence.
Rochelle would have been in serious trouble. Now, if Rochelle had, in present-day Australia, if Rochelle had a couple of members of outlaw motorcycle gangs here, there are proposed laws at the moment that are being considered in Australia that would make, in effect, association between members of biker gangs a consorting offence.
So it's coming back.
It's coming back, you know, 100 years later.
So can you tell me it's such a comprehensive book. What's some of the most interesting facts you've kind of unearthed in your digging?
Well, I mean, you can't research 2,000 plus cases without forming a few views on crime trends, and I'll come back to that, you know, if you're interested in a moment. But, I mean, just some of the truth is stranger than fiction. Duh, we know that. One of the cases, I think, Ernest Baker. Ernest Baker in the 1930s was a white drover living up in on the Alexandria Station in Northern Territory. He fell in love with what they then called a Lubra, a young Aboriginal girl, 19-year-old Phyllis. Phyllis became pregnant to him. He, of course, was then obliged to go off driving, as drovers do. And while he was away, he was so besotted and madly in love with her, he kept showering her with gifts and sending her letters by carrier pigeon or however they did it in those days, saying, you know, I'm worried about our child being taken away by the missions. I'm worried about you not having me there with you. I'm worried about other men on the station coming after you and backdooring me. And in the end, Phyllis did form an association with one of the other members of the station. Ernest came back and in a sort of really tragic sort of way, accidentally killed the roommate of the person that was the suspicious party. Now, I reckon that's a better film script than Australia.
You're right.
You have everything there. You have black and white. You have love between black and white. You have the half-caste child. You have, I mean, that
there's consorting in there.
Well, probably, yes, amongst drovers.
One of the things I found when I was sort of flicking through is, like, great references, like as you were mentioning, to the Kangaroo Gang and the Overcoat Gang, and, like, there's great, details about Alphonse Gangitano, and that not only is he known as the Robert De Niro of Lygon Street, which, of course, is something that many people have heard about, but in his willie, however, he gave his occupation as a gentleman.
Yes.
So these lovely little lines and bits of information and intel or intelligence, where did you get those sorts of things from?
Well, we actually managed to track down, through sort of various networks, people that actually dated those guys and, had personal relations with them. I can't go any further
divulge
than that.
Yourself,
right. But, right. I mean, also, let's be frank, before I became a lawyer, before I went to law school, I was an actress who was supporting my acting habit by working, slinging beers across the Esplanade Hotel. And let me tell you, I came across a few people who are at least related to people in this book.
Okay.
Susanna, who gets the longest entry in the compendium? Is it Ned Kelly or someone like that?
No, I don't think it's Ned Kelly. We sort of give him a cursory glance because, he's sort of...
He's covered
he's
elsewhere.
He's expected to be there. The longest entry... Gee, I'd say it would be one of the... We do these things called breakouts, which are essays, and I think probably the Hanging and Life Sentences essay or breakout is one of the longest ones because, of course, the history of hangings in Australia and then the life sentences which came in lieu of hanging, and whether life means life or whether life means 12 years, which at one stage it pretty much did.
Right.
I mean, that's a really interesting, complex story, especially given we have, for a tiny little country of 20 million people, we have 7 or 8 jurisdictions.
Mm. What about shortest entry? Did you manage to find room for the drawn-on sunglasses bandit from the northern, I think the Mornington Peninsula in the mid-90s? There was a bloke who was robbing 7-Elevens by just drawing with a felt pen some sunglasses on himself. I mean, I think the feeblest disguise ever.
Was he successful?
He got away with it a couple of times, but it was quickly identified because he used, the one that doesn't come off on the whiteboard?
Yeah, the methylated spirits is a dead giveaway, isn't it, around the eyebrows?
What about Gregory David Roberts, Susanna? Did you do one on him? The guy who ended up writing the novel Shantaram that was a big hit. At one point he was Australia's most wanted man. And he I think the fascinating thing about his very, very big-selling novel is that it is a novel, and yet almost everyone who buys that book knows that it's imbued with so much of his real story that they sort of read it as true crime, don't they,
Rochelle?
Yeah,
they do.
Well, there's another one called Mr. Nice, which is about this fellow in England who, after sort of being in jail in England and in America, has written his biography, and he sounds like a really fabulous guy. You'd want to have a coffee with him or something. I mean, that's one of the things about the characters in the book. Not all of them I know like the back of my hand. I have to say that my collaborator, James, is like a world expert, particularly in criminal gangs, but he's just a mine of information. James is the kind of researcher, and I'm looking at Rochelle, because I'm curious about how you go about it. He can spend literally 8 hours a day in the microfiche room of the Victorian State Library. I, on the other hand, after about a half an hour of looking through those microfiches which kind of spin in front of you, I feel like I'm one of those hurdy-gurdies about to throw up. What I am is I'm the Ostley girl. I'm the girl who reads all the cases. Since I went to law school, first year law school, crime and contract law, I just loved reading cases. And now I can't get enough. Mm. I was listening to your interview before the news, and I think one of the most tragic and slightly confronting things I can say is that if you wanted to really write a true crime bestseller, you do the top 100 rapes of Australia. Now, that makes me feel sick saying that, but I reckon there is a prurient interest in the life of crime. When I'm looking through the cases, there are some absolutely diabolical people.
Mm-hmm.
There's Bandali Debs, and there's some the Bernies, and really diabolical people. But then there's others who are intelligent and interesting, and you sort of think, well, there, but for the grace of the goddess, go I.
Mm. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because there is that real cross-section. You know, you've got people like Brendan Abbott who have got extremely high IQs and learnt how to rob banks by realising that the banks are only alarmed from the front and they're not alarmed on the top. And then you've got other individuals that I won't mention that, you know, virtually have got a very low IQ, as they say, you know, like the size of their shoe.
Yeah.
But so... The interesting thing that I found in this book, unlike some of the existing books that obviously now have already been published, this included judges and it included police and barristers. Now, why did you decide to do that?
Because they're all part of the criminal justice picture. They, you know, if there was a painting done by one of the grand masters of the criminal justice system, of course there'd be judges and lawyers and policemen, and there's even a police dog.
There's obviously been a lot of pixelation in that painting.
Yes, that's right. Block out this judge, block out that offender.
A police dog?
He was a famous police dog.
Right. And what about the police horse? Because that was also a famous police horse, gendarme.
Oh, I'm not sure that we have the famous police horse.
Here we go.
Next edition.
Next edition.
People will be going through this looking for ideas for TV programs, surely, because people are obsessed with your underbelly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I reckon there's just a million film scripts in here. I mean, there's the case of Eugenia Fellini, who in around 1921... In the 1916 era, she signed on as a cabin boy under the name Harry Crawford. She was an Italian woman and became a man, became Harry Crawford. Via New Zealand, came to Australia, married a woman. Some years later, murdered the wife, did some time in jail. There's photographs of her in the book. And it is a bit hard to tell, I have to tell you that. You know, either way, you can take it either way. But she had a daughter, which she palmed off as her daughter, that she was the father of the daughter. And then eventually, you know, after her release from jail, she married another woman. And I understand that the relationship was maintained by what was delicately called mechanical means.
Right.
Probably
just look up mechanical means.
In the index of that.
You just can't go past real life, can you, for situations like that?
No.
I mean, I found what was so great, what I enjoyed about Underbelly is that you had something that looked like, from a distance, an episode of Stingers or something like that, but then you just had wild plot twists that no writer would come up with.
Mm-hmm.
There's an assassination on somebody, and as they're driving away, they get into a road rage incident, and then that person gets killed.
Mm.
You know, you'd never write that.
No, and I think perhaps there was some editing so that it made it a little bit more television friendly. In fact, I said to my 12-year-old son, yes, you can watch Underbelly with me sitting next to you. However, then you have to read the chapter in Gangland Australia, which explains, you know, all the detail and the fact that it wasn't such a glamorous life and that they did end up dead and that they did go to jail.
That's what I have a problem with too, because I think the program actually has straddles rather uncomfortably fiction and non-fiction. And I suppose for a drama series, that's great, but it is very loosely based on fact. And
glamorising it. I mean, I found
they were all so beautiful.
People were walking down the street in slow motion with music playing. I'm going, there wasn't any of that in The Sopranos.
And let's also face it, Tony, when you see any sort of a scene of violence, it's sexed up. It looks like an MTV video clip. Someone like one of the Moran boys getting out a baseball bat and then hitting someone over the scone is actually choreographed tightly. It looks sexy, it looks dynamic,
and
it kind of looks
under
groovy
it.
And it's like got guitar riffs underneath it. And it, you know, I mean, I know that sells and I know the program's done extraordinarily well, but it's not reality, is it? It's true crime, and acts of violence are incredibly tragic and sad and depressing, to be frank.
That's right.
And I should just quickly mention before we say goodbye to Susanna Lobez that I had to fill in an employment form here at the ABC for the first time in 8 years, and the last time I was employed by the ABC was with Susanna on Law Matters.
Yeah, 2002 on a TV show.
We did a television show, 15 minutes each week, about what was going on in the world of law, and I did the little vignettes, little...
colour and movement pieces.
Exactly, I dressed up as a judge and ran a 400.
Can
and
we... Is it possible to type this into YouTube?
I'm sure it's still there lurking around. Actually, we had fun, Tony, didn't we?
It was great.
Taking the law out to the people.
Really was good.
Well, Susanna, thanks for being on the couch tonight.
Tony, I've been enjoying being cosied up with you three.
This is a very thick and a great-looking book as far as I can see. I'm going to be getting into that during the break.
Dangerous to Know, an Australasian Crime Compendium.
Very, very comprehensive. I've been skimming it rather extensively, and it's
a skimmer rather than a reader, I think.
It is a skimmer, and it's something... That's the only other thing I was going to say. Have you aimed it at your producer and your author, or more at...
We've aimed it at the guys that want to pay for the book.
That's good.
And it's interesting, the demographics of those people, because people say, you know, young males, but lots and lots of women buy crime books as
well.
They do. But it's the sort of thing you can dip in and out of, and sure, it's a great resource.
Well, thanks, Susanna, and thank you, Rochelle,
My pleasure,
for setting
Tony
up the couch.
Thank you, Tony and Tony.
My producer is saying to me, during the break... What sort of nonsensical commercial radio phrase is that? I meant during the song, of course. It's a break before we venture into, you know, that's pretty serious stuff. Dangerous to know. But we've got Derek Gill's quiz coming up.
That's scary.
Oh, yeah.
That is scary.
Lock yourself in.
And before that, believe it or not, we're going to be playing The Velvet Underground with Stephanie Says on 774. That's the Velvet Underground. I didn't think I'd ever hear them on Derek Gill's program here on 774 Melbourne. And, of course, ABC Victoria, Tony Martin and Tony Wilson filling in. Are we going to... Do you want to do it? The quiz? You reckon we're up to another one?
Absolutely we are.
Okay.
I heard last night that it was a little hard.
Really? The questions were too hard?
That was a little bit...
Wasn't just the shambolic presentation?
No, apparently the clock did a great job and the vicar's bell was very popular.
All right, the number to call is 1300 222 774. We'll be back after this.
Want tickets to this year's AFL Grand Final? Then get on board ABC Grandstand's Grand Final Grab. For your chance to win Grand Final tickets, upload a picture of your best grab to the ABC Melbourne website. It can be a picture of a grab on or off the field. Go to abc.net.au/Melbourne and hit the competitions and events page for more information. You don't have to be this guy to enter.
Oh, that's
774 ABC Melbourne and Grandstand's Grand Final Grab.
Okay, we've got a scrutineer tonight. Sean McAuliffe, would you sign in, please?
Yes, hello. I'm Sean McAuliffe, and I'm a scrutineer. And I've heard Derek's and participated in Derek's quiz, so I'm here to, you know, be his custodian.
He's got also a legal background, Tony. So
and a quiz show.
Absolutely. So everything.
All those things say that Sean should be here. We're
here
about
we go.
To start.
Steady. Here he comes. This bit.
Oh no! Keeps going.
Your 10 minutes starts now.
All right, who have we got? Firstly, Dean from Shepparton. Are you on the line, sir?
Yeah, I am. How are you going?
All right.
Dean, the carryover question from yesterday. We were looking at the last long play album released by Michael Jackson. I think I gave the clue that it was 2001.
Thriller.
Oh, and that was the answer we got yesterday.
That's right.
And I said it was 17 years to the right.
See, I would have figured in 24 hours somebody would have Googled this.
Yeah.
I didn't hear it last night. It's the first time I've rung up.
All right. Well, thanks, Dean. Jenny from Warragul, do you have any idea what Michael Jackson's ironically titled last album was?
I wish I wasn't the second person. And is that the name of it?
No. Yeah, we need the name.
I'm sorry.
Okay, well, the number to call is 1300 222 774. Joel from North Melbourne, do you know...
Oh, 9 minutes.
Sorry, the vicar's gone past on his bike again. Do you know what the name...
His story?
No, it wasn't his story. That was the greatest hits, but there was one after that.
Okay, cheers.
Okay.
We're looking for a long play album... the most recent long play, leaving aside compilations.
1300 222 774. Do you know what Sean McAuliffe
Well, I've got... I got a sneaky suspicion this is wrong. Vainglorious? Is it called Vainglorious?
Great one. That would have been a good one. But Anthony from Oakley, do you have any idea what it was called?
The Michael Jackson album?
The last Michael Jackson...
Yeah, history?
No, there was one after that.
Has Derek ever done one question for the 10 minutes?
Let's see if we can pad it out. 1-300-222-774. Patrick from Melbourne, do you know what the album was?
Patrick. He's got his own
game. Yeah, hi. It's Invincible.
Invincible.
Oh, we got there. Thank goodness for that. Patrick, how many goals did the How many goals did the Socceroos score at the 2006 World Cup finals in Germany?
We beat Japan 2-1, lost to Brazil. I'm going to say 7.
No, that's not right.
It's a ridiculous question anyway. Who have we got? Is it Patrick? Are you there?
Yes.
Patrick? No, sorry. That's Sean McCartney pretending to wedge his way in to the quiz. Max from Roeville.
Hello, sirs.
I don't know what the question was. It was something about sport.
How many goals did the Socceroos score in Germany at the World Cup?
6.
Oh, we... Going in the right direction, but it's wrong.
1-300-222-774. What is the prize pack? Dangle a carrot
if
you could,
we've got
Mr. Wilson.
How to Be Comfy by Shannon Lush and Jennifer Fleming. There's a welcome mat on the cover.
Minutes.
We've got the Gruen Transfer Series 2, and we've got an album called For You Classical Love Songs, which includes Puccini's O Suavo Funicula.
Well, can I guess?
Yeah.
80?
80? Is that would 80 incorrect. Ever happen?
Incorrect.
Do we have Max from Roeville? No, Max from Roeville is refusing to speak. Jody from Melbourne is with us.
Yep.
Any ideas?
5.
Yes,
5. Correct.
They were scored by Tim Cahill 2 against Japan, John Aloisi 1 against Japan, Harry Kuehl 1, and Craig Moore 1. Very good. Next question. All right. Let's just shuffle.
These questions
here.
Are all over the floor. Derek Gill wouldn't allow this.
What hit US television show is Australian actor Jesse Spencer a star of?
House.
Ah, correct. On what show did he play the character Billy Kennedy from 1994 to 2000?
6 minutes.
Neighbours.
Very good.
What controversial political party was founded by his parents, Robin and Rodney Spencer?
I don't know. I've got no idea.
Do you want to have a guess? Controversial political parties that you may see in the Senate tickets in particular?
Family First.
That's not correct. That's it's a great effort, though.
It's a good guess. Tom from Preston, do you know what the party was?
The Greens.
Controversial? Only in Herald Sun editorials. No, I don't think so.
Sorry, Tom. The number, of course, 1-300-222-774. Lyndon from Callista. Do you know what the party was?
No idea.
No idea? Let's throw it to Paul from Ferntree Gully, home of the former Swagman family restaurant. Do you know what the party was?
Yeah, I've been to the Swagman.
Before it burnt down.
Would it be the marijuana party?
No. I'll give you an acronym.
5 minutes.
Can I have a go?
Yes.
Likud? Is it Likud?
The acronym is AAFI.
Angus from Melbourne. There's a clue for you.
Well, that's all right. That's direct.
This is a tough one.
Do you give it up?
No. I don't know. Derek Gill. What would Derek Gill do? This is one of those moments. Travis from Traugan. Do you know what the controversial party founded by the parents of somebody who was in Neighbours and House was?
Would it be the Shooters Party?
It's even more controversial than that, could I say?
Wow, we've pretty much gone
through. They ended up being a part of the of One Nation. But they had their own party for a while.
1-300-222-774. Ned from Yarraville, do you know what we're talking about?
Australians Against Further Immigration.
Yes.
Ah, yes.
Correct. Reading comprehension for preschool parents. In the Maisie books, what is Charlie?
4 minutes.
A rabbit.
I know this. But I can't enter. It'd be like Derek answering his own questions. He wouldn't do it, would he?
I've heard an episode where he did that, when nobody called in.
All right, well, I'm ready. I'm ready with the right answer, and I just know that.
Peter from Camberwell, are you on board?
Yes.
What's the question, Tony?
In the Maisie books, and my two-year-old is listening this evening, what is Charlie? And by that, I mean, what sort of beast is he,
It's
really?
Not heroin. No. It's not the answer.
A mouse.
No. Charlie the mouse.
It's the opposite of a mouse.
Sort of is, yeah. It's not a mouse.
What's the opposite of a mouse?
It could have an opposite.
A piano.
It's a beard.
That number again is 1-300-222-774. Tallulah is a baby chicken. Cyril is a squirrel. Panda is a soft toy. What is Charlie?
Maybe Hugh from Bentley has the answer. Do you know, sir?
You've named Cyril and Tallulah. I'll just turn the radio down. Sorry, is...
3 minutes?
No, Ella's the elephant. This is killing me. I can't believe I rang.
It's the opposite of a mouse, apparently.
Wow.
Eats chickens.
Eats chickens.
Opposite of a mouse, eats chickens. No, I cannot. This is killing me. But I can recite May as he goes to bed. Does that help?
No.
No, it's charming, though.
I'm really not paying attention when I'm reading this story 50 times a week, am I?
Well, sorry, Hugh. We're going to throw it to Mark from Ivanhoe. Do you know the answer?
Charlie, he's a crocodile.
Mark, congratulations.
There you go.
You haven't quite got there yet.
It's the opposite of a mouse, really?
Okay. Last night, people had trouble with what electorate does Kevin Rudd represent.
He called in himself and didn't know.
What strip club did Kevin Rudd visit in New York where the story broke in the prelude to the 2007 election? What was the name of the strip club?
Any clues, I suppose.
Oh, I think I'll give a clue
Two
on
minutes.
That. What the word is something people say they might have done if they've been out having a big night.
A night on the town.
It's also
what a lovely club that'd be.
A night on the town.
I'm going to a night on the town, darling.
Goodbye. Night.
See, you'd throw him off the scent.
You would. We're going to have to go to David from Coburg. Do you know what the name of the strip club that Kevin Rudd went to was?
I certainly do.
Yes?
Crazy Charlie's Crocodile Club.
I think that man deserves a prize, but that is not the correct answer. Wayne from Ballarat, do you have any idea?
He's hung up. He's run away.
It can also denote a number. So, you know, like a dozen means 12. Well,
let's see if Karen knows what it is. Karen, do you know?
This is your last minute.
I really want this prize to go off. Come on, Karen.
Oh, I've got no idea. I said scores.
Yeah, yes.
Scores.
Ah. Scores.
That was the one.
That absolutely is the one. As I shuffle my way through.
That means she's won. She's won, yeah.
No, that's you've amazing.
Got to has the buzzer gone off? We're in the last minute. You've got to keep going.
Keep going.
Which iconic... I'm going to find the one. How many verses are there of Advance Australia Fair?
Oh, dear.
Think I'll big say, here.
Four?
Oh, you knew the name of a New York strip club, but not how many verses in our own national anthem. Sorry, Karen, we're going to Travis from Northcote. Do you know how many verses?
Three.
No.
No, sorry. Stacey from Reservoir, how many verses in the national anthem?
Five.
Correct. Jockey's dispute was resolved today. How many times can those little men...
Seven.
Yes!
Seven, yes. The amazing prize pack.
They can now belt horses seven times in the last 100 metres. How to Be Comfy is Yours by Shannon Lush and Jennifer Fleming. The Gruen Transfer Series 2 is also yours, as is the beautiful For You Classical Love Songs compilation.
Oh, excellent.
Congratulations.
Congratulations. I think we need to step into the showers. Let's have some music, and then we'll be back for a proper conversation with Sean McAuliffe here on 774. Here come the Stones. Give me a shoulder. That is Gimme Shelter by the Rolling Stones here at 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria with Tony Martin and Tony Wilson filling in for Derek Gill. I was tricked by our producer into saying Give Me a Shoulder.
That sounds like a good song.
That's not something I would ever say, Sean McAuliffe. I think you'd attest to that. I would never say Bruce Springsteen or The Strolling Bones.
No, you would not say these things, but I really like the idea of a song called Give Me a Shoulder. I think that's a nice, isn't that a nice gentle song? It'd be good at this hour. Derek would love a song like that.
It should be sung by a 50-something American crooner.
Yeah, so what's the guy's name? What's the guy's name who was in that Bond film? Wayne Newton.
Wayne Newton
should sing that song.
Was he in a Bond film?
Yeah, he was in a Bond film.
He was in Naked Gun 2.
No, he was in a Bond film, and he played a preacher man, and it was one of the Pierce Brosnan ones, and he lived in a volcano or something. I can't remember the details. It was very entertaining.
Do you live in a volcano? I'd like to picture you living in a volcano.
I'd love to live in a volcano.
Are you on some sort of break because you've had your massive success with talking about your generation? I know ABC listeners would probably be furious with the number of apostrophes in that title.
Yeah, no, and they were wrong too. A lot of them, a couple of them were upside down.
Really?
Yeah, the wrong way. You know, we had letters of complaint. I'm sure there were
so
ABC listeners.
So what's the rule?
Well, apparently, if it's fat at the top and skinny at the bottom with a point on it, that's right. But if it's round at the bottom and skinny at the top, that's wrong.
So that's a talking mark, is it?
Yeah, I don't know.
When there's a letter missing, you're meant to do fat at the top and
that's
skinny
right, that's
at the
right.
bottom.
I forget the distinction. I just remember being upbraided for it. I had nothing to do with it. You know, I didn't call the show anything. I just came in. I fired the gun. That's all. I didn't load it.
But you had trouble like this years ago with the McAuliffe program. What was the... Because somebody... You had it originally without...
Oh, yeah, well, it was spelled P-R-O-G-R-A-M.
Now, that's correct, isn't it?
Well, I thought it was correct, but we got lots of complaints, so we had to change it to P-R-O-G-R-A-M-M-E, which apparently is correct, although I thought it was a bit American to call it that.
I think it's a bit American to drop the M-E. The old sort of... The English, because France is close, have just grabbed it and have the double M-E.
Well, I don't want to
the Americans have dropped the M-E, but we've gone in the direction of America, and surely Program Now doesn't have a double M-E when you're talking about something on telly.
Well, we really opened a can of worms with that one. I know that a program in a theatre is supposed to be double M-E.
Yeah.
But if you watch a program on television, that would be a G-R-A-M, I would think.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Look, it was years ago, and we resolved it by splitting the season into two, and we hopefully, you know, disenchanted as many people as we satisfied by calling it.
And then, of course, Series 3 was Pogrom.
Yeah, we left the R out completely.
And Series 4 is going to be Pogrom.
But what was great about that was the announcers were forced to say Pogrom. That's what I enjoyed.
Yeah, well, the problem with the third one, which was Pogrom, was that the spell check has changed to Pogrom.
Oh, did they?
Yes, which is, you know, slightly less amusing show about Russia.
Certainly. Now, Sean, I phoned you up the other day and you announced that you were watching Winchester 73.
Man, what a great film.
The Anthony Mann Western, possibly the first of the series he did with Jimmy Stewart.
He took Jimmy Stewart. Jimmy Stewart at that point was a sort of a sentimental actor. You know, he played characters with a lot of heart and family figures. And Anthony Mann took him and turned him into this vengeful killer.
He was a bastard once man had his way.
Yeah, and he was great in this film. You've seen this film, Winchester 73. Tony, have you seen Winchester 73?
I haven't seen it.
Great film. No music in it. It's not a musical. It's a hard, gritty, it's a drama. It's got a lot of hate in it. It's a film with hate. All Western should be, you know, pretty much based on hate.
It's got a good shootout in the rocks.
Oh, it's great.
At the end.
I don't know. Am I spoiling if I say it's his brother he kills? Am I spoiling it if I say that? See, you wouldn't get a film like that now. The film now would tell you that they're brothers straight up. It's like The Proposition. They tell you they're brothers. There'd be no doubt. They wouldn't save it to the end like that. I'm sorry if I've ruined it for anybody. You particularly, Mr. Wilson. I'm sorry.
I find Westerns really difficult.
Really?
I find the whole sort of water trough and the swinging doors and the hats and the horses. And I like it when they punch the horse in Blazing Saddles, but, you know, that's about... And then I did watch the first series of Deadwood, and Tony Martin told me that I would get over my problem with the hats through watching Deadwood. But I still don't put it in the same category as...
That wasn't like a Western. They hardly ever went outside, did they?
Yeah.
There was a horse in the opening titles.
The W-H-O-R horse, or no?
But there was no, I don't think that you saw a horse in the show.
No.
Hardly ever.
No. You know, if give you a primer, I reckon, if you want to get into Westerns, the best Western to go and see, and it's a more recent one, is probably that Clint Eastwood one that came out about 4 years ago, The Unforgiven. I think that would be...
Four years ago?
17 years ago.
Was that 17 years ago? I can't remember.
That is a beauty.
It's a good film.
Yeah.
What about My Darling Clementine with Henry Fonda as Wyatt Earp? You've never seen that?
I haven't seen that.
That's a great film.
The Searchers? You've never seen that?
The Searchers is one of the best films. How could you not see that? What are you, an idiot? What about Back to the Future 3? Have you seen that one?
There you go. That's a Western.
That's a Western.
What about The Shakiest Gun in the West with Don Knotts?
That's a great film. Have you seen that? You know, how many shots did he fire at the end? He was trying to work it out.
I could never work it out.
One in the pants, one in the window. What about the Don Knotts films? Have you seen? This is great. This is why I came in, because you can't get any other radio show. I came on the show once with Derek, and he refused to talk about Don Knotts. But
did you mention The Incredible Mr. Limpet?
It's a great film. It's animation and live action. You'd love that, Tony.
And a Western?
No, it's not a Western. No, no. What
about The Ghost of Mr. Chicken? That was his biggest hit.
That's great. You know, they tried to clean blood off the piano keys, and they couldn't. They even used Bon Ami. What about The Reluctant Astronaut? Have you seen that? That's a fine film.
Here's a trivia fact for you. The Ghost of Mr. Chicken was so popular in New Zealand that The Reluctant Astronaut was retitled Mr. Chicken Goes to the Moon, just for New Zealand.
That's very Japanese. That doesn't make any sense.
The best one is The Love God.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen The Love God?
No, I haven't seen The Love God. No, he writes a book. Does he write a book? And
He's a small-town ornithologist, of course, in a tweed jacket, yeah. And he does bird calls. And due to a series of misunderstandings and mix-ups, he becomes Hugh Hefner. He becomes, like, the sexiest man.
So this would be 1970?
It's about maybe 69, but it's... There's just endless montages of Don Knotts as a love god. And I always remember, and just costume changes, Austin Powers style. And I always remember the opening titles. It's like a triple joke. They go, Don Knotts is the love god. Right, you think that's a joke in itself.
Sure, not a great one, but it's a joke.
So they go, Don Knotts is the love god. Then a question mark appears. And you go, okay, that's probably enough. You've underlined it enough. But then, on the soundtrack, you just hear Don Knotts' voice, just disembodied, go, the love god. That comes in over the question mark.
It's still a great film, though, I bet.
You don't know any of these films?
Did you see the American version of Robin's Nest? TV series. Don Knotts played the neighbour. He played
in Three's Company?
Yeah.
Oh, no, hang on, Robin's Nest. You mean the American version of Man About the House?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, John Ritter played the
come and knock on our door.
Yeah, he played that guy, and Don Knotts actually played the guy next door to the Ropers.
He?
Yeah,
did he?
Yeah,
because the Ropers was Norman Fell, who'd already played Dustin Hoffman's landlord
in The Graduate.
In The Graduate, there you go.
Seen The Graduate.
Okay, bang. There's something.
There we won.
I've been trying to convince Sean. I've been trying to convince Tony to watch Singing in the Rain, which I still always say is my favourite film.
Which is also David Stratton's favourite film.
Oh, I'm going to have to change it now. Really?
Why?
No, it is. It's a great. You've seen it. It's a great film.
Yeah.
And people think, it's going to be. It's going to be a gay old musical, but it isn't. It's hilariously funny. It's satirical. The humour in it is very modern.
It is very funny. It works even now, because my kids and I, we watched it about a month ago, and we laughed.
We danced to the song Singing in the Rain, my daughter and I. It's one of her favourite songs, because it's played on Play School, and all I watch is Play School.
That's not the same. The film is different to the Play School
the
version of one song. In fact, there's a few versions of the film. You could see the one starring Buster Keaton. Buster Keaton is in a version of Singing
in
the Rain.
That's right. It's very early days of sound, and it's done to Noah's Ark.
Mm.
So there's like Noah's Ark with Singing in the Rain. That's odd, very odd.
You're writing this down? This is a good film to see.
You are listening to Tony Martin and Tony Wilson and Sean McAuliffe on 774 ABC Melbourne. And the time, I don't think I've mentioned the time at all on the program. It's 10 to 9. Time to play some Frank Sinatra. I'm trying to play some Frank Sinatra every night, Sean.
Right.
What I wanted to do is play a track from A Swingin' Affair, which is certainly in the top five of the Capitol albums. And I was going to play At Long Last Love, and then I remembered it's cursed. Did you know that song was cursed?
No, I didn't. Why is that? Why is it cursed?
Because apparently Cole Porter was out riding his horse. There was an accident. The horse fell on him, crushed and broke both of his legs, and while he was lying there waiting to be rescued, he wrote the song At Long Last Love. So, and of course it is,
why is it cursed? I mean, he wrote it after he fell off the horse.
He did, but then everyone who's had a crack at it, something bad's happened. Remember Peter Bogdanovich's film of At Long Last Love, that nearly ended his career.
What about Old MacDonald Had a Farm? Sinatra does a great version of that. Is that on that album?
And on that farm he had some chicks. That is a great,
E-O.
But it's, and this may be a reference to Don Rickles somewhere in the lyrics, but that's was that a single? It comes as a bonus track, I think, possibly on the CD of Sinatra's Swingin' Session. But what I thought I'd do is I'd play From This Moment On, because this is a singing lesson, people. Listen to how it builds from A Swingin' Affair here on 774 Frank Sinatra. That is Frank Sinatra from this moment on, from A Swingin' Affair. Sean McAuliffe is with us on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. Tony Martin and Tony Wilson filling in for Derek Giel. Sean, you've brought in a giant hardcover book. What's that?
I didn't write this book. I know that you're trying to convince Tony Wilson to watch a musical, Singin' in the Rain, and this book is great, Tony. You can have a look. You can get any film at all you have a question of. Just ask me, and I can look it up really quickly and answer them. You know, the great films from right back from the Jazz Singer. Start from the Jazz Singer. It's the first musical on film, 1921 or something.
Hey, well, what's the second musical with sound?
That was the Coconuts with the Marx Brothers.
Really?
The Jazz Singer, because we mentioned...
Was there a race? A bit like the 4-Minute Mile? When you know how...
To get the first sound film out.
Yeah, well, I think so, because the Jazz Singer's a cheat. The Jazz Singer's only got musical numbers, and the rest of it's silent. So it's not really a musical film. The Marx Brothers' Coconuts was the first talkie musical.
And in Singin' in the Rain, which one of the things that makes Singin' in the Rain so great is it's about something. It's about the transition from silent films to sound films, and it's full of scenes with executives running in going, the Jazz Singer's huge, we're going sound. And I always wondered, wouldn't it be great if there was that sort of sensation when Neil Diamond's Jazz Singer had come out. If it had changed films that much. But okay, so what? Name an old film and he'll look it up. He'll tell you something.
Any
amazing
old film, assuming you know the name of it,
okay.
I can look it up.
Farewell, Mr. Chips.
Farewell, Mr. Bill Chips.
Thank you, Mr. Chips.
No,
Mr. Chips.
Goodbye, too. Mr. Chips.
Come in, Mr. Chips.
Yes. See you later, Mr. Chips.
Mr. Chips rides again.
Well, I can tell you a bit. I didn't have to look it up. There's a musical version of Goodbye, Mr. Chips starring Peter O'Toole, and it's from...
And Petula Clark from 1969. That's the remake. Musical. Yeah. It is a musical.
Musical. Awful.
Or I heard it was awful.
Like the musical version of Lost Horizon. Terrible.
Oh, my God, that is awful.
Dreadful.
I saw An Affair to Remember for the first time the other day.
Well, that's not a musical.
Not a musical. You need only musicals in that.
Well, mind you, we're trying to encourage you, and we've just said Lost Horizon and Goodbye, Mr. Chips are appalling.
Yeah.
What do you think of A Fair to Remember? That's a fine film. Cary Grant and Deborah Kerr.
Leo McCarey, I think, might have directed that.
I'm surprised he's so popular. Cary Grant, everything I've seen him, and even in North by Northwest.
What are you talking about?
You're nuts.
He has just suaveness and beauty.
He has comedy, he can do pratfalls. Have you seen The Awful Truth? He's an acrobat.
Yeah, have you seen Bringing Up Baby? That's hilarious.
What about His Girl Friday? You've never seen His Girl Friday. The greatest newspaper movie of all time.
Rosalind Russell and that they speak so quickly, it's great.
Fastest talking movie ever made.
If anyone else would like to sit in this seat...
Father Goose. Have you seen Father Goose?
I'm drawing the line at Father Goose.
Oh, Father Goose is a fine film. I'm not hearing a word against it.
Houseboat. Now, I love how you were positing your excuse as being that you've just had a baby. Tony, you've obviously got hands full.
Yeah.
So you don't have time to watch any films. Sean has three children. He's still cranking through them.
But he was just saying that his children are at the age where they want to sit down and watch a Buster Keaton film.
That's true. Very hard when they're like 3 weeks old. It's hard for the attention span to last. You show them The General, you know, which runs 90 minutes, and a three-week-old baby isn't going to follow it.
Doesn't understand the sophistication of the ladder work that Buster's doing.
Have you must have conditioned your children to enjoy, I mean, because... Most children wouldn't like a Buster Keaton film.
I did. I had to work in. This is how you do it. Okay, this is good for the listeners as well. You introduce them to the shorts of Laurel and Hardy first, because they're like, you know, they're not very long. They're only 20 minutes long. When they're about 5 years old, they'll enjoy watching Laurel and Hardy because they're like kids and it's really funny and they laugh at that. Then Chaplin, introduce them to the Chaplin shorts, really enjoy that. And then maybe a feature. You know, like a Chaplin feature, maybe The Great Dictator's a bit much.
Yes.
But you get away with Modern Times. They'd enjoy Modern Times.
A bit where he goes through the machine.
We are not finished with this. We are going to continue this conversation in the next hour here on 774. News is next.
Tony Martin and Tony Wilson on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
Certainly is. Filling in for Derek Giel, who's doing the conversation hour in the mornings, apparently, Tony. Were you aware of that?
Yes, I was made aware of it yesterday. Doing a sterling job, too, is Derek.
And Sean McAuliffe is with us. We've been talking about old films because that's what we like to do. Sean, I've been receiving SMSs from John. Ask Sean the breed of his dog.
Yep.
I didn't even know you had a dog.
I haven't. No, we bought a dog for the children.
What sort of dog?
I hate to say this. I don't like saying this word. It's a cross between a spaniel and a poodle.
Is that
so
a
you don't
spoodle?
Want to say
spoodle? It is a spoodle.
Yeah, don't say that word. I don't like that
word. It's not a panniel.
No, it's not a panniel. I'd like a panniel. Panniel I could say. I can't say the other word because it just feels unmanly.
Do you think...
it's bad enough I have to walk the thing, let alone answer people's queries as to what it is.
Are there any of those hybrids that you like?
Like to say or just like generally?
Well, just think, because I agree with you that there's a cringe factor with the word spoodle.
Yeah. Well, it's not natural, is it? What's the other one?
Labradoodle.
Labradoodle. Yeah, I can't. I can't even look and admit that one exists.
I feel bad having just said it.
Labradoodle, for me, is like one of those Etch-a-Sketch machines, you know?
It sounds like a word when you can't think of a word. Get the labradoodle.
Yeah.
A fill-in word. Simon is listening in Dubbo via the internet. And he claims that I recommended two films years ago and he watched them both and enjoyed them, and they were Top Secret and Midnight Run.
Midnight's a great film.
It's my emergency. Everyone knows. But I bore people with Midnight Run.
And Tony put me on a Midnight Run, and I can also say that's one of the greats.
Do you like Midnight Run? I know you like it because it's a fine film. It stars Charles Grodin, one of your favourite comedian stroke actors.
And De Niro is funny, isn't it?
Do you like it because they went and shot the river scene in New Zealand? Is that why you like it?
I didn't realise that till I read one of Charles Grodin's many autobiographies, that I think when they fall in the river, that's America, and once they're in the river, that's New Zealand.
Yeah, it's a year later in New Zealand.
You know, it's the reason I always go on about it and recommend it is because it's the only film I know that everyone likes. How many films are there like that?
None.
Hardly any. Not Singing in the Rain, clearly.
What about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance
Kid? See, I know people who hate that.
Really? Why do they hate it?
They don't like the ending. They don't like the freeze frame.
Oh. The ending?
Well, what do they want? What do they want him to die?
Do they want it to be the whole bunch?
Yeah, actually, there's a worse ending to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and that's the sequel, which is actually a prequel, which is Butch and Sundance, God. The Early Years, starring William Catt.
The greatest American hero.
And some other guy I don't know.
And directed by Richard Lester.
Oh, really? He directed that? Well, I have to have a look at it again. Mm. You turned me around just with that name alone. You know who Dick Lester is, don't you, Tony Wilson?
Tell me what he's done.
He's directed Superman 2.
Yes, that was
the Beatles films. Hard Day's Night. Help.
Funny thing happened on the way to the Forum.
The Three Musketeers, The Four Musketeers, Royal Flash, The Knack and How to Get It, the running, jumping, standing still film, Petulia with George C. Scott, The Bed Sitting Room, How I Won the War.
I know that. That's got John Lennon in it.
It's actually tedious. Sorry, is that offensive?
No, is that an opinion?
I'm not allowed to have opinions.
It's terrible. Can I have one? It's awful.
That is. You're a guest, so you can have as many opinions as you want.
As much as I love John Lennon, I like seeing John Lennon even when he is in a dull film, like the one with the bus and everything that they did. A terrible film.
Bus?
Yeah, you know, the awful film, the Magical Mystery Tour.
Oh yes,
dreadful. Mm. Dreadful. Mm.
I saw little bits of them in the anthology with Paul McCartney up in his little submarine capsule. Do you remember that? He spent much of it standing as though he was in a boat pilot's spot.
Did he?
No.
I've never made it all the way through.
No,
Magical Mystery Tour. It's only about 45 minutes.
Well, hang on, that's a musical. Did you enjoy it?
The anthology?
Yeah.
I love that. Magical Mystery Tour, I only saw the bits in the anthology.
Oh, okay. It doesn't count.
Richard Lester, Juggernaut. Juggernaut, I saw that when I was a kid. That's when a bomb is on a large ship. That was the first movie I saw that had the, do I cut the red wire or the blue wire?
Oh, really? Oh, that's a fine moment.
It's exciting when you first see it.
So this gentleman who you spoke to many years ago and recommended those two films, if you had to recommend a third film, what would it be? What would your trio be?
It's tough for like a crowd pleaser. Well, Top Secret isn't for everybody, I have to say.
I'm surprised at that. I didn't enjoy that film, but I'm happy to go with it. What about Pee-wee's Big Adventure? Isn't that a fine film?
Oh, I like Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Yeah, I like that film too.
Have you seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure,
no.
Tony?
Annie Hall.
That's a beauty.
That's a good film. We'll put that in the three.
Still holds up. And the most famous, well, as I mentioned recently on the internet, the most famous credit spelling error, Annie Hall. In the opening credits, Christopher Walken. Closing credits, Christopher Walken.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's not like Woody.
A Best Picture winner.
That's terrible. We should give the Oscar back.
We haven't received any other SMSs about films. Nothing about Don Knotts. I'm sure we've left out one of the key Don Knotts films. I would have thought somebody would have SMSed in about that. Tony, what is your emergency recommendation?
Well, Annie Hall. I've just punched that out. Mm. I'd also put up there. Oh, no, go to Sean first.
Well, you know what they were originally going to call Annie Hall. You know what Woody Allen's preferred title for Annie Hall was? Anhedonia.
Which is a psychological...
It's the opposite of hedonism.
Condition, the inability to experience pleasure. It's not a good title for a film, no, really.
They talked him out of it.
And Annie Hall was only a small part... The character of Annie Hall was only a small part of it, wasn't she? It was like a supporting character.
That's right. I mean, originally when Woody Allen and Marshall Brickman wrote Annie Hall, it included a murder plot in there, which eventually turned up as Manhattan Murder Mystery. Many years later, he sort of broke it off and left it in the drawer. And that's actually based on... It's the same two characters, and apparently that's where the film was originally supposed to go. But he liked all the memory stuff so much because it led to the storytelling of the film, that's how it worked out. And the editor, whose name was Ralph Rosenblum,
yes,
he's the one who really put that film together. Isn't that interesting?
And other scenes, I think the scene where he goes to hell that's in Deconstructing Harry, mm-hmm, wasn't that originally in Annie Hall?
I think most of the things that are in the last 50 Woody Allen films were originally in Annie Hall. It was a good summer.
And Manhattan Murder Mystery, actually quite underrated. Had a look at that recently.
Very funny. It's got there are very few films you can get that have a good laugh on the last line. You know, there's some like it hot, hilarious last line. Won't tell you what it is.
Schindler's List.
Schindler's List, again, a real hilarious...
It comes out of nowhere, but there it is.
It's there. And then Manhattan Murder Mystery. And a Dust Boot, too. It doesn't go down well because not everyone speaks German.
So what was the last great Woody Allen...
Let me think now. I'd say it was, for my money, you know, the last funny one that I really enjoyed was the one where he was blind.
That was a really great
premise.
Directing
a film.
It was a great premise, but most people hate it, Sean.
Really?
I would be cautious about recommending it.
No,
Hollywood Ending is the name
Hollywood
of it.
Hollywood Ending. Taleone, hilarious in it.
But it is one of the great premises.
Blind man directing a film.
Yeah, it's really good, except for the film. Do you know what I mean?
The actual film. So as soon as the opening titles finish...
No, I just loved the idea of the film, yeah. and then I didn't really love the film.
No. Well, you got to love the film. I don't think it's enough to love the idea.
I quite liked Mighty Aphrodite.
Sure, that was a fine film.
It was all right. Husbands and Wives, that's a while back.
That was a good film.
That was
too.
Pretty good.
That was good.
And what was the one where Sean Penn was a guitarist, like Django Reinhardt?
Django Reinhardt? I don't think that name wouldn't have been spoken on radio for... I don't know, 25 years.
He doesn't get much of a run. Sweet and Lowdown was the name of it. That wasn't bad, although I'm not sure that was even a comedy.
Did you see Woody Allen in The Sunshine Boys, the TV movie version of The Sunshine Boys?
Did you like that?
With Peter Falk? No, I hated it.
That was
terrible.
Really poor. That was just miscasting, is that all that was?
Oh. I can't. I'm sorry I even brought it up.
What's the one where he's chasing a severed hand? I swear to you, there's someone else's film that Woody Allen's in and he's chasing a severed hand that's got a sacred significance. It's got a ring on it. Yeah. Sharon Stone is in it. It's from the guy who did Like Water for Chocolate, who, if you remember...
Well, what's the number? People should ring in.
It was called Picking Up the Pieces.
Oh.
And the guy who did Like Water for Chocolate, the director of that,
mm-hmm,
he was... I'll tell you who he was. He was an actor. He was in Three Amigos with Steve Martin. He was El Guape,
bad
guy,
yeah,
who was obsessed with the word plethora. And he was also the bad guy in The Wild Bunch.
A fine actor.
I can't remember his name. We should know his name. That's very poor.
Fred Asparagus? Was it Fred Asparagus?
Fred Asparagus was. It was a genuine asparagus. 1-300.
222.
774 is the number to call.
Who needs a quiz?
Sean, I think we've got further guests to get to. We could obviously sit here and waffle on like this till sun up.
I know, but you don't want to get axed this early. I'll go. I'll leave you to your real guests.
Is there anything we can mention, talking about your generation? Fantastic success of that. Is it coming back?
Look, it might come back next year. You just never know.
I've heard rumours you've got some kind of CD. Is that under wraps?
Oh, yeah.
Falling over it? Shouldn't mention that.
I should have brought... I had the master in the car. I could have brought it up. We could
really
have played some. Maybe next time. Yes, I have a CD coming out in November.
CD. I love the idea.
Comedy
that
CD.
I love someone who's still making comedy albums.
I actually wanted to make a comedy LP, you know, on vinyl and everything. I didn't want a CD. I didn't want to go commercial. I really want to make it really obscure.
With the going all the way onto the runoff
group.
Yeah,
just so they could play it in the clubs.
Drop some beats under it. Sean McAuliffe, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
And we're going to have a bit of Tom Waits from the Tony Wilson collection. We'll be back with more on 774. That's Tom Waits. I hope that I don't fall in love with you here on 774, ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. Tony Martin and Tony Wilson. Which album? Which Tom Waits album?
Closing Time. Oh, that's good, I think before his voice, some people fall into the camp where they love Tom after the alcohol and cigarettes have ripped the hell out of the larynx. And some people like, you know, Heart of Saturday Night and Closing Time when he's still got some semblance of voice box left.
Rain Dogs is my favourite.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
But Sawfish Trombones was where the trouble started, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's when he just started hitting garbage tins for whole songs.
Yeah, pretty much. But I think Closing Time, something like 1972 or 73. It's pretty early.
Wow. All right. Well, we might have some more. I'd like to play something from Rain Dogs over the next 2 weeks. That's what we're doing. We're filling in for the next 2 weeks. Although I should point out we're not doing Fridays because I'm told there's some football going on in this town.
Footscray have to play St Kilda. They're called the Western Bulldogs, actually, now. Right. But they're playing St Kilda on Friday, and then Collingwood are playing Geelong on Saturday. They'll both be fabulous games. Tony, you can come around to my house, and I'll tell you about the shape of the ball and the direction that they have to move it and all that sort of thing.
Don Knotts Festival this weekend. Let's talk about some theatre. Let's talk about something proper, and that is The Cat's Paw. That's a play which is opening this Thursday at the Carlton Courthouse Theatre. We have the writer of the play, Christine Croydon, with us. Welcome aboard here on Evenings
Thank
on 774.
Me.
I hope you weren't expecting Derek Gill because
I knew he wasn't going to be here.
He's not. Now tell us, this is a, don't mind out my idiotic comments from time to time, but this is about a serious subject. It's a response to raunch culture. Now, for those who haven't been paying attention, what is raunch culture?
Well, I'd say it's sort of media-saturated, sexualised culture that's all around us now and that we've probably become a little bit desensitised to. And, I've been wanting to write a play about, you know, responding to this. And I suppose I've set it in the world of the sex industry because I think that's where the greatest exploitation of young people occurs.
Now, when I was a kid, if you saw a prostitute in a TV show like Starsky and Hutch or something like that, that wasn't something to aspire to.
Definitely
I mean, I'm not putting down people who are working as prostitutes, but I'm saying it wasn't a role model.
Is it
Paris Hilton? Is it people like that who have made this seem like an attractive proposition?
Well, I don't think they can make anything. I mean, values are renegotiated in society all the time, and culture is us. Mm. And, you know, we just create it, we sustain it, we buy it. So if we want to change it, we sort of have to try and change it from within. So I suppose asking questions, and that's what a play is about. Like, why, for example, are so many young women entering the sex industry when we're sort of living in a time when you think that young women are more empowered than ever before? And I suppose that is a fact, and that sort of made me think, oh, well, maybe I'll do a bit of research and write
about
this.
There was a book that was released, I think, maybe 2 years ago, Female Chauvinist Pigs by Ariel Levy.
That's right.
It was a magnificent book, a really compelling, just a piece of like journalism, really. I think she writes for the New York
The
New Yorker, and it talked about the way that there's this sort of belief that that raunch culture and sexualizing everything is empowering to women, that it's somehow it's owning the sexual image, and we're now, because men for years have been blasé about sex and have spoken dirty to each other, and our way of owning that is this sort of pole dancing lessons out in.
Yeah,
Is it picking up on those sorts of themes, this play?
The play, not really. The play is just about one young woman's journey, you know, in this sort of industry. And the characters, there's three very young characters and, the two older characters. And it really is just two non-consecutive nights on the streets of somewhere that could be St Kilda or any red light district in the world, really. And because it's a play, it's an imagined world.
Now tell us how you came to, you've had experience of working with people, with women wanting to get out of that industry and get into
briefly,
writing.
Yes, yes. I did work for Project Respect, and they work with women in the sex industry. They have outreach workers who visit brothels, and they do all sorts of work. And what I was involved in was just a small thing that was to try and help women who wanted to exit the industry.
And get into creative writing. I mean,
oh,
I
not
think
really.
That's,
that was just a...
That's an interesting idea, though.
Yeah, not really.
And
yeah.
It's been successful for,
the
for,
Pathways
for a few
program.
People.
Yes, it has. Well, there are a lot of people writing books who have had experience in that industry. I think, what was it, Kate Holden wrote a memoir.
That's right.
A
I didn't want to. I thought it would have been rude to
yeah,
focus on that, but you're right,
that
Kate
was
Holden.
A few years ago now.
She's visiting Tuscany now and writing about
that's
things
right.
like that.
She writes for The Age now. But, yes, look, and there's also many, many people, male and female, who enjoy their work in the sex industry, and they see it as a flexible, lucrative, legitimate profession. And, you know, this is I'm not in any way interested in speaking on behalf of those people. This play is not about a group of people who enjoy their work. It's about young characters who are in a very exploitative sort of environment.
Now, you said, off-air, you said to me you've written two plays before this.
I've written comedies. I've written three comedies,
Comedies.
So, this is a bit of a turnaround.
And
but comedy and tragedy sit cheek by jowl, so I think this is a bit of a contemporary tragedy.
And how do you... Okay, so you've delivered the script to... I mean, how did you go about mounting this?
Well,
how
Wayne
did you
Pern,
choose
who is the artistic director of Hoi Polloi Theatre, I showed the script to him over a year ago, and he liked it, and he said, we're going to do this, and that's fantastic. So we had a professional reading, and he and I met for coffees over the last year or so and just tweaked the script, and I showed him what I'd done, and we talked about it. And then at the beginning of this year, I rang him, and I said, I really think it's the time for this play. And fortunately, he believed me, and they're producing it. Hoi Polloi are good. They produce quite a few Australian plays. They did The Real Thring last year by Barry Dickens.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And they've got another one coming up after mine, which is written by a young man, Brian Davidson Blue, playwright. So.
And what's it like sitting there in the audience during rehearsals, watching people say...
I haven't been to that many.
You haven't, really?
Yeah, it's good. It's great to watch it develop and change with the actors, and it really transforms the whole thing.
Do you get any rewrite rights after it's in the production
period? I can
period?
Tweak things, and if the actors are having some trouble with some of the words, we can rearrange them and change them. And, you know, there's all of that. That's all development, and that's wonderful. And it's just a great thing to have the opportunity to do this.
Now, it says you've written a couple of novels for young adults.
That's right, yeah.
Can you tell us those?
Well, one's called The Painted Portal, and the other one's called The Memory Thief.
I always find it, don't you? You could confirm this, Tony. It's ghettoising books. I've read, do you know a book called King Dork? This is a book I recommend to a lot of people. And it's a really funny novel by an American writer called Frank Portman. Oh. And I got almost to the end of it before I looked at the back of the book and it said young adult. And I had no idea. I was just going, this is just a hilarious...
I love reading young adult fiction too, and I read a lot of it, so...
It's a spectacular book, that one. It's a sort of anti-Catcher in the Rye, I guess. It's
anti-Catcher
kind of,
in the Rye.
The front cover, in fact, is a defaced Catcher in the Rye.
Well, not the local edition, but the original. It's a great cover.
And he's been a punk guitarist for 20 years. His first novel was King Dork.
Oh.
And really a sensational read. But it is interesting that the publishers want to latch on to a label for what the book is.
Yeah, well, a lot of them, I mean, I love stories about young people finding their place in the world. And I suppose this play is really about young people struggling to find their place in a very different sort of world. But, yeah, it's just a great genre, and a lot of them cross over as adult, but I actually am very happy to read young adult fiction.
Well, The Cat's Paw is opening at the Carlton Courthouse on Thursday. I mean, I'm saying, you know, good luck on the opening night.
Thank you very much.
It's going to be a great night for you, seeing, I guess, your first produced play.
Yes.
But then again, you've tackled a serious subject as well. So,
well, hopefully it'll go well. The
only,
a
night
only
of
way
mixed
to do
emotion.
It is see what an audience, see how the audience receives it.
Well, thanks for joining us
and
here.
And thank you for having me.
No, it's great. Well done, everybody concerned, and good luck on Thursday night. We're going to play some music now. Greg from Rosebud has been very impressed by the music we're playing, Tony.
That's very nice, Greg. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg, for coming.
We won't ask you to be specific as to whether it's been this Tony or other Tony's songs that you've liked, because we've had one each just about,
haven't
we?
And John, our producer, he's contributing when he's not getting back rubs from the various guests. Sorry, I was misusing the crime couch earlier, I have to say. Let's have some Loudon Wainwright III, and we'll be back with more music, live music, here in the studio on 774.
Living on the side of Primrose Hill, drinking cans of Tennent's, just can't seem to get my fill. Got a beat up guitar and a dirty old sleeping bag, and this mangy dog whose tail don't wag. Sun's been shining down on my hillside bed. That's not the only reason my face is so red. This nasty cut on my nose, it's not from no fight. I just fell down yesterday, or maybe it was last night. And I used to sing and play down in the underground. A few years back they started cracking down. I'm living on the side of Primrose Hill. I'm no tourist attraction, but I give them a thrill. See you riding by on your flash bicycle. Hey, they can do you for that on Primrose Hill. A pretty young mother goes by, she's pushing her pram. A little baby leans out just to see what I am. From the top of the hill, there's a hell of a view. Houses of Parliament and London Zoo. Those politicians all chatter, they trumpet and roar. That must be what those hyenas all are laughing for. When you come up to London, sure is something to see. Somewhere to go, no place to be. And there's two things keeping me from going round the bend. I got my music and this dog for a friend. Life gets slippery when you're living on the side. Yeah, I know I should quit drinking, but I haven't even tried. My mud's licking my fingers and I'm wetting my lips. We got a can of extra strong and a bag of chicken and chips. If I had a little money, I'd get a few things, like a bottle of vodka and a pack of new guitar strings. I guess I could die here on the side of this hill. I'm no tourist attraction, but I'd give them a chill. And I'm living on the side of Primrose Hill, drinking cans of Tennent's, just can't seem to get my fill. Got a beat up guitar and a dirty old sleeping bag, and this mangy dog whose tail won't wag.
That'd be Loudon Wainwright III, Primrose Hill, here on 774 ABC Melbourne with Tony Martin and Tony Wilson, ABC Victoria, also on board. We love it, having a bit of live music in the studio, do we not, Tony?
Two nights in a row. We had James in last night. And tonight, it's me and the grown-ups.
Certainly is. We have Anita Lester, Jonathan Dreyfuss and Adrian Sergovich with us. They are fully geared up and ready to play. Let's just go straight into a song, guys. What have you got for us?
And we're going to play a song called Yellow Raincoat.
Take it away.
Adjustments to a little bean heart. She is breathless underneath the tube from which she feeds. She crawls, begins to walk to her brother's bedside, takes it step by step till she falls to the floor and gets back up again to find her yellow raincoat and steps into the rain, the place from which she came. And by the night this woman is dripping, burning into the pouring black sky, and she is walking into a movie, her life flickering so quickly, and they were watching, the crowds were looking, and they were trying. And she learns the poet's dreams and writes amongst the trees to find a little peace of mind from the home she left behind when she was 21, wiping tears from her mother's eyes with her father's sleeves. And she finds the man of her dreams, or so it seems, until 2,000 days later he finds another lover who leaves her all alone with a baby on her back, dress you she hardly had, she never had, after she was just 16, waiting by the train line steps for the man she really truly loved, who never came to meet her in a velvet blue dress she stole from a stranger, and lipstick too red for her face. And she is trying to remember her past, the black holes growing fast, and they were watching, the crowds were looking at a poor mother crying. Sleeping one single dimple deep inside her slightly aging skin that she pulls back in the mirror and remembers the days when her back didn't ache. She danced inside the rain, and the man who left her bedside appeared a few years later with a bunch of wilting flowers he said he'd had for hours, and he cried himself to sleep for the way he cut her deep. So she led him into sore wounds and loved him once again, and she tired of working hard, so she left her painted job and didn't miss it for a moment, didn't miss the life she had. She felt at 53 she'd found her own way home to the place where she was supposed to be, and hunched in her chair she rocks.
Amazing.
thank you.
Well, that was amazing. Me and the grown-ups performing Yellow Raincoat live here in the studios at 774. Guys, your album, Battling the Mountains, the Sky and the Sea, is getting rave reviews. You must be pretty happy with yourselves at this point, I would have thought.
We were terribly happy with that one when it was released last year in 2008. The one that's that was released this February, Knowing Lovers, Naive Lovers, is actually doing even better.
But I've been checking out your reviews. People love to talk about the way you record these albums. What is it that you're doing differently?
We do it at my house.
Your house?
And I think that's probably it.
Not too many overdubs?
No, we, well, the first two albums where we were doing it acoustically, really, and we didn't really do too many overdubs, but the third album is going to be something like you might see tomorrow at the Astor. Oh, no, Thursday, actually.
Thursday at the Astor.
Yeah, we're going to have a mini orchestra there. The third album's going to take us away from this kind of acoustic live sound.
And what's happening? Is it that it's the 21st anniversary of the Astor, is it, or something?
27th.
Oh, sorry, I'm 6 years behind. One album behind and 6 years behind. The Astor. I've never been. Have you been to see music at the Astor?
No, I haven't.
They used to have INXS, and who else was playing?
I think Iggy Pop.
Iggy Pop played
the Astor.
Yeah. It's a kind of new thing that they're starting to do again.
Does the cat make a run for the exit when the...
The cat loves the violin. It's bizarre, but Marzipan is the name of the tortoiseshell pussycat that lives there. I'm a big cat person, and Marzipan likes the violin.
Is it the same cat that's been there?
I think it is.
I was there years ago when Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet was playing at the Astor, and about 5 minutes in, the cat just went, no. Nah. Thumbs down. Two paws down. I'm out of here.
No, two stars, David. Two stars.
Is there a... You mentioned that INXS once played at the Astor. Is there a thing... I heard an act recently say, the Beatles played this stage. That's right. The Flaming Lips were very excited that the Beatles had played Festival Hall and it actually really meant a lot to them. Is there a moment you've stood on stage where you've thought, one of my heroes has stood here?
I think, well, we played at the Fly-By Night in Perth, which has held the greatest musicians in...
Is that in Fremantle?
Yeah.
I've played there. Did you play it in summer?
No, we played on a Monday night in the middle of winter.
The Fly-By Night is basically, if you can imagine, a 44-gallon drum cut in half down the centre and then tipped over. It's a metal hanger. In summer, that is just a kiln.
Yeah, and in winter, it's an icebox. It's horrible, but it was so lovely. Everyone was freezing to death, and everyone was kind of crowding around the tiny candles that were on the table, but it was the most amazing gig, and everyone just responded so well. And not only that, it's just full of history and a beautiful place, and it smells like history as well.
I had the same thing when we played at the Basement in Sydney and when we played at the Spiegel Tent in Melbourne, again, venues with huge history, and you just sort of stand there and I don't so much think about who's played there. You can just sort of feel the presence of great musicians having been there. And I'm not sure, we're going to Brisbane actually tomorrow to play the Spiegel Tent and then the Astor on Thursday night. You know, we keep busy. And I'm kind of wondering whether it's going to be the same thing in Brisbane, because there are a lot of different Spiegel Tents that go around.
Is that right? It's not the one that's in... So Australia has its own Spiegel Tent?
No, it's a European one. The one that comes to Melbourne was built in Belgium, we found out. But the one which goes to Brisbane actually is run by a different company, and we should find out where that one's from.
I saw Bill Hicks in the Spiegel Tent in Edinburgh in 1991. Damn. And then when I saw someone here, I thought, I'd like to think it's the same one. Because it's a big thing to ship around, I would have thought.
Yeah, it's kind of a big arrangement to do, but they do it every year. They're not doing it this year, actually, I believe.
Yeah.
Song for repair.
Is there another viola act going around at the moment, or are you guys the leading viola act in the country?
I wouldn't say that too loudly in front of Brett Dean, Australia's preeminent violist, who had a great career in the Berlin Philharmonic. But in terms of pop viola... Yeah, it kind of cuts from John Cale to me. And that's not being egotistical. It really sort of does.
Now, Jonathan, I hope you won't mind, but you are you not the son of George Dreyfus?
Of who, sorry?
And I wouldn't have brought it up.
How dare you?
I wouldn't have brought it up except that I was involved in something a few years ago that did make misuse of one of his most famous pieces of music, the theme to Rush. The Olden Days, it was called. We redubbed. But we didn't muck around with the music. The purity of the music remained.
Oh, so you didn't do a techno remix?
No, we redubbed all the voices from the TV show.
Oh,
but we,
right.
We did leave the actual music alone.
Oh, right. Well, Dad was actually on this show last week at this time slot too.
Was he?
For a little bit of symmetry for a concert which we had on Sunday in the Hawthorne Town Hall, which was great. And actually, most of the musicians who played there are coming back to play at the Astor this week. So we've got a kind of father-son employment racket happening at the moment.
Well, this is... I don't know if anyone's listening on the internet in Brisbane, but you're saying you're at the Spiegeltent tomorrow night?
Yeah.
And, of course, the Astor on Thursday night.
Should we demand another song,
I think
Tony?
We've got to have another song from me and the grown-ups.
Sure.
What have you got for us?
This is called The Burning. It's sort of heavily inspired by a Radiohead song called There There, which is our favourite band.
I love There There.
It's a great song.
Let's
it's one of my
well, what happened with this one was we do covers of songs we either love or hate. So,
right.
Actually, like either there'll be songs we want to mock or songs that we really love at the Astor, we're doing a song that we really love, which is Reckoner by Radiohead, and a song that's a bit fun to mock, which is the Doctor Who theme. And
by Ron Grainer?
Yes.
Was it, I think?
Yeah. Well, we did Lady Gaga on our tour, and that was pretty... I got a few laughs. But, yeah, we did There for a cover. And Adrian and I had to work out how to replace this five-piece, three-guitar, bass, drums band with just our little combination. And the backing we came up with we were so fond of that we slotted it into the next song that Anita brought in.
Well, let's hear it. This is me and the grown-ups live in the studio at 774.
I'm painting a picture that you'll never see, and you'll know that it's you, but not drawn by me. And if ever you pass it, you feel it go through you, for my eyes were a camera, are yours too. Your eyes are camera, mine are too. I'm sewing a doll with no fingers and face, just so I can put yours in that blank space. And this is the story that narrates my days, but this book is not yet done. The end's not in place. Yeah, this book is not yet done. No, the end's not in place. And that was the burning, and this is the look. And that was the fire for me you mistook. And that was the love which I nearly touched. And I want that feeling, and that feeling's a must. After it shut and I couldn't see you. Yeah, soon after it shut and I couldn't see you. I'm sewing a doll with no fingers and face, just so I can put yours in that blank space. And this is the story that narrates my days, but this book is not yet done. The end's not in place. Yeah, this book is not yet done. No, the end's not in place. And that was the water where I nearly drowned, and I was the daughter that floated around, and that was the love which I nearly gave. And I just can't sleep 'cause you cut like a blade. And that was the burning, and this is the look. And that was the lightning for me you mistook. And that was the love which I never touched. And I want that feeling, and that feeling's a must.
The Burning, that's live in the studio, me and the grown-ups here. Jonathan Dreyfuss, Anita Lester, Adrian Sergovich, thanks very much for coming
in. Thank you so much for having us.
And the Astor Theatre, it's just any excuse to go to the Astor Theatre, I find, is a good one, and that's happening this Thursday. For tickets, call the box office on 9510-1414. I think the audience out there is demanding weather at this point. That'll be next on 774. You're listening to Tony Martin and Tony Wilson filling in for Derek Giel. Pardon me. 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. Fancy some weather, Tony?
Would indeed liked some weather.
Are you there, Terry Ryan?
Yes, I'm still recovered from last night.
Yeah, I think my idiotic comments were unwelcome. I'll have to say that. So I'm gonna let you go. I'm not gonna make any comments about Kanye West during tonight's broadcast.
That was interesting, though, wasn't it?
It was. But what have you got for
interruptions? We've got a fine night tonight with temperatures starting to fall a bit across the state. We've got 5 or 6 degrees in a lot of areas so far. But a northerly wind will spring up tomorrow, and we'll have some rain coming in the far west late in the day, and they're reaching the Melbourne area overnight, it looks like, and moving across during Thursday. So there's a good chance of getting some rainfall Wednesday night in through Thursday morning in particular, and clearing later Thursday as it the system moves away. Got a wind change coming through around about midday-ish, it looks like, 11, 12 on Thursday in the Melbourne area. And then the change after that, should things should clear. And by Friday, just some showers in the far eastern parts of the state. Saturday is not looking too bad, with the winds going back to the west on Saturday and not much happening then. And variable winds on Sunday, and some rain coming in from the north. We've got rain again lined up for Monday next week. So we've got some opportunity there for rain for a couple of days, particularly late tomorrow, and then raining Thursday. And it's not going to be very cold either. We have 25 degrees tomorrow in Melbourne, 9 to 25, cloud increasing in the afternoon, and some rain in the evening or at night. And that rain will be around on Thursday, but clearing late afternoon or evening, 14 to 19 on Thursday. Sunny Friday, 7 to 20, so not a bad evening for the footy at the MCG. And Saturday, mainly sunny, northerly winds picking up a bit, becoming lighter in the evening, though, 10 to 24. So 20 and 24 for Friday and Saturday, quite warm weather for this time of the year. Mainly sunny, you're very quiet there. You still there?
No, yes. We are still. Terry, I've got a question for you, Terry. I wanted to let you finish before I asked it. But I've got a friend who I believe isn't very tough and doesn't face up to adversity very well. And he's won the nickname 21 and still, because I believe that is the most comfortable, the least oppressive conditions that you can be in. So I call Sam Pang 21 and still. Would you agree that 21 is the absolute most comfortable you can be, or do you think it should be 23 and still?
Yeah, 21's a bit low. He doesn't feel cool at 21, does he?
Oh, I haven't asked him. I made up the number myself, thinking that 21 was where a lot of air conditioners are set.
Yeah, they are set for around about that. It'd probably be okay. In the tropics, 21 and cool. Very humid could be a bit... Very humid morning in the tropics, you might feel a bit muggy at 21.
Okay.
But it's not a bad way to go for southern areas of Australia, I suppose, 21.
Thanks very much, Terry.
Good one. Yep.
And I love it when you say things like, we've got rain lined up for Monday. It sounds like you're controlling it, like you're just sending a bit through.
We need it, Terry, so thank you for delivering.
We certainly do. God. A lot more.
Good on you down there at the Bureau. Let's have some more music, not live this time. This is Gillian Welch with Elvis Presley Blues, not Bruise, here at 774. Elvis Presley Blues from Gillian. I apologise, not Gillian Welch. I hope it's Welsh. Not Welsh. So much trouble you can get into on the radio. Here at 774 with Tony Martin and Tony Wilson filling in for Derek Giel, who you can hear tomorrow morning on The Conversation Hour. It's been quite a packed show tonight, hasn't it?
It has. You don't have any time. Oh, you know, I had explanations for some of my quiz answers, but the people don't want them. You know, when I said that there are five verses of Advance Australia Fair, do you want one of the lesser known ones?
Yeah, give it to us, please. What, the one that they never get to?
Yeah. What about, well,
it's not
verse
blue, is
two?
It?
Well, the verse two, the one you think is verse two is actually verse three. Beneath our radiant southern cross, right, we'll toil with heart and hands. Have you ever heard that bit?
No, no.
To make this commonwealth of ours renowned of all the lands. For those who've come across the seas with boundless plains to share. It goes on. But that's actually verse three.
Right.
Verse two, when gallant Cook from Albion sailed to trace wide oceans o'er. True British courage bore him on till he landed on our shore. That doesn't rhyme with
Should I be
our.
Standing for this? Should we be standing
No, these
up?
Are the little known verses that okay. you don't have to get up
you
for.
You can just crouch.
Then here he raised old England's flag, the standard of the brave. With all her faults, we love her still. Britannia rules the waves.
Oh, wow.
We left that out because it's all about England.
It certainly is. Well, New Zealand, we have God Defend New Zealand as our national anthem. It's basically help.
And you've got our flag, but with red eye from staying awake too long.
It's time for us to sign off. DC Root from the band Root will be with us tomorrow night, as will Tracy Harvey. And yes, the quiz is back. News coming up next here on 774.
Good night.
Good night.